to Unspeakable, the podcast of The Unspeakable Oath, our more or less quarterly magazine of Cthulhu Mythos role-playing and other Cthulhu Mythos awesomeness, but mostly role-playing. I'm Shane Ivey, editor of The Unspeakable Oath and managing editor and whatnot at Arc Dream Publishing. And I am here with Scott Glancy, of Pagan Publishing, and Ross Payton of Role Playing Public Radio, and John Scott Tynes, our special guest for tonight's podcast. So now that I've gone over all your names without letting any of you talk so people can identify you by ear, Scott, why don't you say hi?
Hello, Internet. Scott Glancy from the last Legionnaire left at Fort Pagan.
Everybody's moved out on you?
Well, no. I mean, I am the only person who works on it full time. Everybody else is sort of, you contract out whenever they're interested and whenever they have time.
Oh, but, I thought you were talking about literally Fort Pagan.
Oh, no, Mr. Place. No, we still have John Crow. John Crow still lives with me. He just has his little nest, I guess you'd call it, on the first floor. Do you remember that episode, first season of X-Files with Doug Hutchinson as the stretchy guy?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, remember that nest he built out of the newspaper? Sure. That's kind of like where John lives, except instead of scraps of newspaper glued together, it's guns.
Right.
He sort of knits them into a kind of bird's nest held together with a secreted resin.
Sounds like a Warren Ellis comic.
It's really not that far off.
That sounds like it'll eventually end really, really well for somebody.
Yes, I'm sure of it.
All right. Ross, why don't you say hello?
Hi, this is Ross Bain from Role Playing Public Radio, and I won't do the announcer voice anymore. So.
And since Tom's not here, I just have to say, seriously, come on.
I think the announcer voice is fine if you're going to commit to doing it through the entire show.
I'll have to do that at some point on RPPR, and then the hate mail will come.
So. I have surgical incisions, and if you make them bleed because you're doing the announcer voice, there's going to be consequences. Most of them will be for me, but there will be consequences.
All right. John Scott Tynes, why don't you say hello to everybody now?
Hello, this is John. I am delighted to be here, and I look forward to the many exciting topics suggested by Oath readers and assorted miscreants on the interwebs, except for those offered by Jonathan Turner, which were completely and utterly without merit.
I think we can all get on board with that. Step it up, JT. All right, so before we go any further, let me talk about the Oath sponsors. We do this every episode, and I'll try to make it really, really short because it all just always just sort of drags on, but they're awesome, so don't blame me. So Atlas Games, who and most of these guys, by the way, have been on board sponsoring the Oath since the very beginning, so buy their stuff, people. Atlas Games has Cthulhu 500. And I will say, on a personal note, they've recently they're partnered up with a video game studio, and they're doing a Kickstarter fundraiser for a computer game version of Ars Magica. So that looks really, really interesting and fun. It's like a long-term strategy RPG on the computer. The H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival, which just happened, but they've got like two a year, apparently.
Well, this one was actually a third one. I would point out that Gwen and Brian Callahan, who run Psycho Graphics, which is a T-shirt company based out of Portland, they also run Arkham Bazaar. They took over the Northern franchise for the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival. And the guys, and Aaron Vanek, who was the guy who directed The Yellow Sign, the film that John Tynes wrote, and was shown at the film festival, he's been running the L.A. one, or really the Long Beach one. And so they split up the year so that the guys up in Portland would be doing it in sort of a March time, and the guys in L.A. would be doing it in October. October had always been the traditional date, but when they did the switch, they didn't have the best response to the March date because people in the North were still thinking October. So they took the Zompire Film Festival, which was something that Andrew Migliori, the original creator of the film festival, did, and they merged it with sort of a teaser for the Lovecraft Film Festival, just a one night each, Lovecraft versus Zombies, and showed it in October as a way to just have it be a big road sign with an arrow to point everybody at the March Festival. So this one was kind of an anomaly, but you're right. This year there's actually going to be three. There's going to be three, but yeah, it's L.A., Portland, and L.A.'s got sort of the October dates, and Portland's got the March dates. So there. So it was a mini festival. I wouldn't call it there's going to be another one coming up in March of 2013, presuming that there is a 2013.
Right. It's funny. Brian and Gwen at Psychographics, even though they're way up in the Northwest these days, I actually met them in person here in Birmingham, Alabama, a few years ago. They were running a little booth selling, you know, all of their stuff, T-shirts and clothes and whatnot, at a tiny little first time convention called Play On Con here in town. And I haven't been back. I've heard that that subsequent, you know, versions of Play On Con have kind of improved, as they always do over time.
Well, Gwen and Brian have that whole gypsy selling at con things down pat.
Right.
They really have it down to a science with their own vehicle, and they work out a schedule in advance for the whole year, and will bounce from con to con to con.
Yeah.
For the summer and the fall.
Yeah. So it was kind of fun though. I mean, it was this little convention. It was local, so my wife Rachel and I set up a booth there for Arc Dream, and then there was them and like two other people in this tiny little room that was the dealer's room for the show.
I've been to that con.
Yeah, and it was like, you know, it had really light traffic, and it was always the same people over and over, because there were like maybe 200 people that came to the thing, and you know, including a couple of really, really creepy customers who were, you know, there specifically to kind of ogle the young teenage gamer boys that had come with their parents.
This is starting to sound like Dragon Con.
it was interesting. So everybody, all of the dealers kind of, you know, would every once in a while give each other these kind of knowing eye rolls from across the room.
did Rachel fire any warning shots to keep the chicken hawks away from the gamers?
Oh, she was watching them like a hawk. Yeah, it was hilarious. My wife Rachel's a police officer, so you know, and we have teenagers of our own, of whom we're, you know, I'm usually extremely mellow and mild, but you know, that's the thing that'll set me off like a psychopath. So I spent most of my time. She sort of was the one running the booth for the most part, and I was running games for, like, you know, the two or three people that were there to play games, you know. And mm-hmm. And then I would occasionally go in and visit and hear the horror stories. And
let's assure the people that, you know, it wasn't actually a, you know, a pedophile hunting.
No.
It was actually a con.
Right. It's a game con. They're still doing it every year, and you know, a bunch of my friends go to it every single year, and they have a great, great time. So no knock on that, but you know,
it wasn't organized by Chris Hansen. Is that what you're trying to get across?
I don't know Chris Hansen. Where's Chris Hansen from?
To Catch a Predator.
Oh, that guy.
No, this was just, I think this was just an unhappy accident. I don't think it had much to do with the,
I gotcha,
you know, with them. So, with the organizers of that show.
Speaking of other creepy things, I think Innsmouth Free Press, they've
yes.
got a...
Yes, our other sponsor, one of our other sponsors, they've got a new collection called Fungi or Fungi. Is it Fungi or Fungi? Anyone know?
Fungi. It's fungi from Yuggoth?
All right.
I've always heard it's fungi.
Because it's fungus, so I guess fungi would, or fungi or whatever. But it's the plural of fungus. And
fungi sounds too much like feng shui. I'm going with fungi. All fungi right. Sounds creepier to me.
Yeah, so... So it's got that amuses me that none of us know how to pronounce that. Seeing as
no,
well,
it's,
we've
I mean,
all read
in the U.S. it's fungi. Yeah. In the U.K., I think it's pronounced differently, but here in America, it's fungi.
Where we do,
because remember, right. There's the Delta Green acronym, the fun guys from Yuggoth.
Sure.
Yes.
Sure.
So
fungi is a collection of fungus themed Lovecraftian stories from Innsmouth Free Press. that's just coming out, like, I think either this month or next month.
Is anybody sitting on the table?
It's either November or December 2012.
Is anyone sitting on the table of contents in front of them?
Not right in front of me. Ross, you can look it up. I remember Jeff Vandermeer is one of the writers, but I remembered that because...
That makes sense. It has really creepy cover art. Every time I see it just...
Yeah.
Here we go. Let's see here. There are quite a few authors.
Yeah, there's a ton of stories.
Vandermeer, Pullen for Blake. There's a few. I don't want to list all of them because I don't. None of the other names jump out at me. But I'll send you the link. But they have quite a few people. There's also three stories in the hardcover edition. They're exclusive to that. From Catherine Tobler, J.T. Glover, and Claude Lemieux. I guess that's French.
I somehow remember a number of Lumley stories that were fungus based. That from way back in the 60s. I was just curious if any of the older stuff had also, but it looks like it's all new.
Yeah, this looks all new. These don't look.
That's good. That's good. That's even better to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then finally, Miskatonic River Press, our good friends over there, run by Tom Lynch, longtime friend of Pagan and Orc Dream alike. Their newest thing is A Season in Carcosa, which is a short story collection focused on the Yellow Sign, the King in Yellow. And
does John any of it? Does John Tynes have anything in that?
I don't know. Does John Tynes have anything in that?
No, I do not. I think that's Pulver's book, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, is it all Joe Pulver? It's not.
No, he was the editor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I talked with him about the book a while back, and I was thinking about trying to write a story for it, but I just got busy and nothing came to mind. So, nope, I missed that boat.
That is a shame for them.
And I've heard a rumor that there's an EPUB and Kindle edition that's out now.
Yes, I just actually converted it for them because I actually asked Tom Lynch from Miskatonic. He's like, "Hey, is there going to be a Kindle version of that? Because I'd like to read that ebook wise." Mm-hmm. Like, no. Well, I was like, "Hey, I can help convert that for you." And so that's how I apparently get work.
You want the product to exist, and then you make it.
Yeah, pretty much.
that approach does wonders in this industry. So if anybody needs to pirate that ebook, Ross is the man to talk to.
No, I don't think he'd get work from him. I don't think that'd be like, hey, I don't think that's a really good, like, testimony. Hey, get this guy to convert your books and he'll give them free on the internet.
Oh, did I mention the big wink? Big wink.
Yeah. I see how it is.
So thank you very much, Atlas and HPL Film Festival and Innsmouth Free Press and Miskatonic River Press. You guys are amazing. And let's kick along to other stuff. We've got a whole ton of news and announcements.
So none of us are actually under the doom of Sandy, right?
Frankenstorm.
Yeah. No.
Yep. Actually, I heard Tom Lynch is. I mean, not on this podcast. I think he's on the East Coast, isn't he?
I personally think he's
up in the Northeast. And Todd Shearer, who does lots and lots of artwork for Arc Dream and has done several Oath covers, is in Silver Spring. So I think he's at, like, on. If you look at the last track that I looked at, it basically went the middle of it went over his house. You know, so. So he's getting lots of rain and intermittent power outages.
So they named this one after Sandy Peterson, right?
I hope so. I believe, Scott, I think it was your wife that put up one of those Facebook memes that had Hurricane Sandy illustrated by Olivia Newton-John's face from Greece, which I thought was hilarious. A little inside joke for all of us
Olivia Newton who?
One of the things I find in sort of Lovecraftian news, there's a one of the sort of tragedies is there is a replica of the HMS Bounty that was lost. And, you know, that's a very kind of like the ship at sea being lost, a tall sailing ship, by the way. Apparently they were trying to sail to Florida to avoid it, and they just weren't fast enough, and they got caught in it.
No.
And, like, two people, man. One person was lost, like all but one of the crew was rescued. One, the captain's still missing. One crew was found 10 hours later in critical condition. She was in a survival suit, so they don't know if she's going to live or not. And the other 14 members were rescued. And it's just – and this is
– This happened just now as part of this storm?
Just today. Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. And it's a ship that was been in several movies. I think it was built for Mutiny on the Bounty, the 60s.
The old Brando one.
Yeah. And but they've used it in Pirates of the Caribbean, and I'm sure some of the Oath readers will know they've they used it in the what was that porn parody of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh,
so
my God.
It's got a storied history, and now it's been reclaimed by the deep ones apparently. So
that's horrible.
Not good to hear anything like that. Not good to hear. Yeah, and I would like to point out that in the show notes, I disagree with Shane about the Elder Signs not working on Shoggoths. I think you're wrong about that, sir.
Oh, am I wrong about that? Okay.
I think that's the whole point. The Elder Signs.
I think an Elder Sign would particularly work on a Shoggoth. That's the deep ones.
Oh, because I might have had that backwards.
It's the sign of the Elder thing.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm stupid. All right, well, never mind.
Aha!
But yeah, seriously, again, everybody, you know, I hope everyone stayed safe. I mean, this will all be past tense by the time anyone hears this.
Oh, yeah.
So
I'll try and get the show out pretty quickly. But
for us right now, it's very suspenseful, and we're kind of worried about
the after effects of the storm are going to last for a while.
Yeah.
So
I'll be interested to see how it affects voting patterns. That's the thing that sort of struck me about this was, you know, showing up right in the middle of or just before the election within 2 weeks. I think it's going to be interesting to see if this has any effect on turnout or the ability to collect votes, you know, in some of these precincts that are going to be a mess.
Yeah. Well, you know, as the Daily Show keeps reminding me, Ohio's the only state that matters, and it's not hitting Ohio.
Yeah.
Well, there are some, if you follow some of the convoluted poll analysis of, like, very wonky sites like 538. There are some, like, a 3% chance one person could get Ohio and still lose. But there's always the chance New Hampshire could change hands. It's mm-hmm. Most of the states that are being affected directly are pretty safe one way or the other for one candidate or the other. None of them are, you know, in the five or six real toss-up states.
I guess if we can combine both the Hurricane Sandy and, you know, the election coming up, there's no matter how the election turns out, we're going to have some conspiracy theories about how the weather machine was used to spin the election. That this was somehow
National Weather Services is run by Obama, after all.
Yeah,
this is true. And there's actually the political news I heard in connection to both was. Some reporter brought up that during the GOP primary debates, Mitt Romney said that FEMA should be relegated back to the state's responsibility, that they should, you know, cut FEMA's budget or remove it entirely. So,
well, it's not like this. It's certainly not like the Sandy's going to run over any serious red states in its trip where it's coming down right now. So people who weren't happy with him, you know, we'll still be unhappy with it after their house is plowed under or they lose their beachfront property.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to change too much.
Well, let's not get too far afield here, but I personally, I wanted to encourage everybody that since we'll probably have this out before the elections happen, I want to encourage everybody to get out there and vote in the U.S. It is important. Even if you're like me and you live in Alabama and nothing I can do will affect the way that Alabama's election is going to turn out, same thing up in the Northwest. I mean, up in Washington and Oregon, you know, there's you guys are going one way and it doesn't really matter. But I think it does matter because, you know, that sort of defeatism is kind of self-fulfilling, you know. If a lot more people were to get out there and vote the way they want, then you'd see things kind of potentially shaking up even in really, really hard-leaning states.
Right.
And, you know, it matters. And I want to encourage everybody to get out there and vote.
You can always vote third party, too. I mean, vote your conscience. So.
Sure. I mean, I feel like the more people that actually exercise their vote, whether they win or lose, the more accountable that holds our government. And that's a tremendously valuable thing in my
Well, and keep in mind.
Oops, sorry, sir.
I keep in mind as well that You know, with the how tight things are looking, this may very well end up being a split election where one candidate wins the electoral college but loses the popular vote. Mm-hmm. And that's one case where, regardless of what state you're in, your vote still counts in the popular vote and can really potentially help to kind of nail that down in a stronger way.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you guys for kind of indulging that, and let's talk about other stuff.
Also Cthulhu.
Yeah. So, oh, before we get to Cthulhu, everybody, listeners, please go online and click on ratings. Like, rate the podcast if you like the podcast. Wherever you bought The Unspeakable Oath, give it a rating, even if it's just clicking one of the stars, preferably the fifth one out of five.
It's our favorite.
That's the best one to click. But or if you want to leave a four word review, whatever you want to do, it makes a huge difference. Our bread and butter is selling straight to fans, and we do that over the internet. And every piece of data about online sales and about selling straight to the consumer shows the tremendous importance of of online ratings, especially those that look like they're actually by people that know what they're talking about. So,
or by people and not ones we wrote ourselves.
Right. So save me the time of cheating and give us an online rating somewhere, especially if you like. And if you hate what we've done, then take that to your grave. that's something you want to keep a secret.
Yeah. You don't have anything nice to say.
Maybe share it with your therapist at some point. That's confidential.
Yeah.
So, all right. So what else is going on? We've got The Oath. 21 came out a couple of months ago. We had it out at Gen Con, and we mailed it out to everybody. And it should be in everyone's hands who pre-ordered or subscribed. And if it's not, then you need to contact me, send an email to shane@arcdream.com and let me know, and or a comment on the unspeakableoath.com or whatever, and I'll sort that out. But we got that out. It was very, very late, but it's there, and I was really, really happy with how it came out.
Don't forget, it's also very, very pretty.
Yeah. Yeah. it was fun. The cover art for that I love, and that's one that Todd Shearer did, and he actually did it before Oath 20 came out, and he decided he didn't really like it very much, and so he came up with a different design for Oath 20 after, you know, my sort of introduction in our editor's column had to do with violence and combat in horror games, and so he sort of keyed the art act off of that. But we had this other piece sort of sitting there, and I just loved it. So when it was time to put 21 together, I said, "Well, why don't you just let me use this?" And he's like, "Okay, I don't really like it, but whatever."
Well, he's wrong.
So that's what I told him. So, and I gave him money. So. it came out great, and we had some really good stuff in there. Sukak Pak was a scenario that Jason Morningstar wrote, who's responsible for Fiasco and Gray Ranks and all kinds of ridiculously good material. And this is a Cthulhu mythos investigation up in Alaska, in sort of deepest, darkest, ruralist Alaska, that's really, really scary and disturbing.
Oh yeah, I read that. It's very interesting. It's the first time I've also doesn't that have rules for it for Cthulhu Dark?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. What he did was Sakakbak evolved because Jason had helped Graham Walmsley put together a book called Stealing Cthulhu, which is a book all about sort of recommended tips of elements to borrow from Lovecraft's stories, but also sort of dissecting and reverse engineering what went into his writing of those stories and how you can use that to inform creating your own adventures in Call of Cthulhu and making them more sort of Lovecraftian, whatever your sort of favorite piece of his stuff is. And And so Jason used the sort of guidelines that Graham came up with his help and Ken Height's help and Gareth Hanrahan's help in stealing Cthulhu to develop this adventure. And as part of that, it includes sort of all the game mechanic-y stuff is keyed to a bunch of different games using this really sharp system of symbols. So, you know, this one symbol indicates this is a fight scene, and, you know, another little mark indicates this is a sand loss, and the number of branches on the little elder sign tells you how severe the sanity loss is, and then you sort of key that to the rules of the game you're playing. It's really, really smart the way that they put that together. We're going to wind up using that again. Greg's got an adventure in the new issue that he designed to be a cross-platform game, a scenario similarly. So that's going to show up again, the thing that Jason and Graham and those guys did.
Yeah, I've always interested in the Cthulhu Dark rules. I'm sure you guys have read it. And I've posted a couple actual plays on there, and I want to play in a game where it's actually played scary, where it's an actual horror game, because every time I can, it's hard for me to, maybe because of the way the rules are set up, to not run it as paranoia with Shoggoths.
Really?
Because it's just, you know, because players determine when you fail. Like, they say, okay, you can't do that, roll die to see if that actually happens. The game master has very little control over it. So we always wind up into player versus player scenarios where, like, no, you're going to roll that die. I want to see if you succeed or not. And it's gets pretty silly at times. But with that scenario right up, I could actually kind of see it working.
That's interesting. You said that you're describing that it's sort of the fact that it's the players that kind of push for the need for a roll.
Well, the game master cannot kill a player without or even drive them insane. The play they succeed on everything until another player challenges them. Mm-hmm. Like the game master says, you can't do that. You know, the player can try that anything or do anything until another player says, no, you'd have to roll to see if you would sneak by the cultist or, you know, whatever. Well, there are some caveats, but it kind of creates a different dynamic than most games.
I'll have to admit, I haven't read that, the rules yet because, well, Poe. But
the complete rules are in Unspeakable Oath 19. It's 2 pages.
Okay, well then that's all.
You already own it.
And I own it, and it's sitting here right in front of me.
And it's also free on Graham's website, thievesoftime.com. Okay, well, it's in Oath 19. He put it in there too.
Clearly, I'm getting it mixed up with wasn't there another Cthulhu system, a Cthulhu role playing game? Tabletop system that was out recently that was all about the thing I remember reading about it was that, oh yeah, if you do encounter the mythos, you just drop dead.
Well, that's Cthulhu Dark's approach. I mean, he basically simplifies.
You can't fight monsters. Yeah. If you fight a monster, you die. That's why monsters don't have stats. But the way it's set up is you cannot die unless you fail a die roll or you lose all your sanity. The only thing is a player has to say no, that you have to roll to see if that works or not, or otherwise the game master says you succeed, I believe is the basic rule for it. So like I said, it's a very unusual dynamic.
What are the, in your experience having run it, Ross, what's the sort of impetus for the players saying yes or no to other players?
Well, the dynamic that I've seen is at first everyone's kind of cooperative and, you know, working together, playing it like Call of Cthulhu or something like that. But then, yeah, here it is. If somebody thinks it would be more interesting if you failed, they describe how you might fail and roll a die. If their die roll is higher than your highest die, you fail in the way that they described. If not, you succeed as before, with your highest die showing how well you succeed. So But once that first player says, no, that wouldn't work, and then you roll off, then it's like, oh, well, you're going to say I get killed.
So it becomes a circle of vengeance amongst the players?
There's like a mutually assured destruction. I mean, characters don't have stats either. You literally just come up with a name and an occupation, and then you can go. So like if a character dies, you know, it's up to the character can be reintroduced instantly, you know, depending on the scenario.
A lot of math to bring it.
Yeah.
Okay, so hence the aspect of being like paranoia. All right.
Yeah. I think it's so, just...
Well, it obviously depends on all the players getting on board up front with a certain tone of play,
yeah.
You know, and agreeing to the ground rules, right?
Definitely.
Well, cool. You've got those actual plays online, even though those came. Those were like that was like a zombie thing you did, right?
We've done two on the RPPR website. One is Caleb ran it from Heaven on Games, and he ran one where the basic premise was Yogg-Sothoth grants a crazed old priest a wish, and that wish was he wishes the Bible was literally true, like all the events of the Bible were literally true. So you have people turning into salt, and he just looked up crazy shit that happened in the Bible, and sort of had us go nuts. And the Earth was flat; we could fall off of it. One Tom died twice by trying to drive out of town, and he kept falling off the same different characters. Like, I drive out of town. Oh, well, you fall off, you know.
Thanks a lot, Yogg-Sothoth.
And then the second game I did was you're on basically the premise of the video game Dead Island. You're on a, you know, tropical resort, and then zombies. What do you do? So, and that was
if it's Dead Island, you kick them to death.
Yeah,
forever and ever and ever and ever.
Yeah. So those are the two games I ran, and I've heard people saying they could play very scary games with it, but I just. I get everyone being into the same vibe because that would be very sensitive to someone else. Fuck it, you fail.
Right. Or, you know, I mean, when you're playing a horror game, you know, it usually gets kind of goofy and funny. I mean, every game, inevitably, it starts getting goofy and funny because the more you ratchet the tension up, the more of a relief it is when it gets released by somebody cracking a joke.
I will point out that the thing that's missing here for me is that I've always been afraid of the dice. And when you had to whip out the dice and do something, now, you know, there are these things that don't give a shit about you. They don't care that, you know, if they, you know, it's not like the other player where you have a relationship with them or you know who they are, you've been involved with them. Maybe he's, you know, maybe John's still upset because I didn't do the dishes and I left them in the sink to molder. And so he's like, no, I don't think you're going to be able to jump from one roof to another to get away from the zombie horde.
Scott, you know, the truth is, like, in all the years playing Cthulhu with the pagan staff, I mean, other players routinely were responsible for our deaths. I mean, we didn't need a mechanic for it. Like, it just happened, you know, just like blithering incompetence.
I realize that there are those moments where, because a player had been out of the, like, John Crow left the game for a couple of hours, and then he had to do was be out of Blair's sight for, you know, his character's out of his sight for a couple of hours. And when he's reintroduced, Blair's like, he's been copied and replaced. I know it. We're going to have to kill him. And I'm like, no, really. He just rode into town to get us some supplies. Oh, yeah, sure. But look how quick he got back. And I'm like, I think you might be overestimating. And before you could say Jack Robinson, he's gunning John down in the middle of the scenario where we didn't even need the monsters to show up. You know, I'm not saying this shit didn't happen, but you know, the dice are always creepier, or the mechanic is always creepier because it, you know, it's sort of, it's not that it's filled with malice or incompetence like pagan publishing players, but it's filled with it doesn't give a shit. When I saw, I always liked that Dread thing with the Jenga tower. I thought that was nerve-wrackingly horrible. The idea of dismantling the Jenga tower, you know. And it gave that marvelous arc of most horror stories where at the beginning everything's easy. Mm-hmm. But as you get deeper into it, suddenly this shit, you know, is a lot more precarious and horrible. And and again, the Jenga Tower doesn't care. It's run by friction and gravity. And if you, you know...
No.
That's all I got to say about that. But
yeah, so the question is, like with the systems in Call of Cthulhu, it's the, you know, the dice represent the existential forces of the uncaring universe deploying your destiny on you. And I guess in this other system we're talking about, it's more like, well, actually, hell is other people.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe Mr. Tynes has summed it up nicely.
Right, right. So, yeah. So that's Sukak Pak.
And Unaussprechlichen Klutzen.
Unaussprechlichen Klutzen was... now, that's by Graham Walmsley, who did Steel of Cthulhu, which inspired Sukak Pak. And that's a playset for Fiasco, which was the role-playing game by Jason Morningstar, who wrote Sukak Pak. And... The Unaussprechlichen Klutzen is it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek parody Cthulhu mythos thing, but it's for Fiasco, which means you're sort of all the players are all together, kind of building up characters and building up the conflicts and the storyline as you go from scratch with sort of a baseline of, you know, character names and situations, and then you sort of take new twists and tweaks and events and complications and from the charts.
Dice rolls determine the plot.
Yeah.
You
choose the dice you want to use and then assign that to an element of the plot. And so that's essentially how it works. And it's a lot of fun. I've played Fiasco many times and it's a very interesting, very cool kind of drama game. You know, it's a role playing game, but it works in a really different way than sort of the traditional role playing games. Because
Tabletop has a couple of episodes on Geek and Sundry.
Yes.
What's his name?
Yeah, Will Wheaton and
Will Wheaton, and I don't remember the rest of the cast. Yeah. One of them,
John Rogers, I think, was in it.
One of them is the showrunner for
Leverage.
Leverage,
yeah, that's
right. John Rogers.
Yeah,
he's actually writing something for Drama System now. He's written because they made that, and he's written some stuff from 4th Ed D&D. He wrote the D&D comic book for IWD, I believe, too. So he's a pretty big geek.
So Unaussprechlichen Klutzen is sort of it's a Fiasco play. The tagline, I don't remember the official tagline for Fiasco, but the whole idea of it is originally was it's supposed to be the role playing game for generating your own Coen Brothers movie. It's a game that sort of encourages bad decisions and really disastrous choices.
And we actually have an actual play of it on RPVR Actual Play with you in it. We played it at Gen
Con. Oh, that's right, yeah.
And John Marin and a few other people. And it ended poorly for almost everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
Every character involved.
Greg Stoltze was playing in that. And then
he was.
I think my friend Simeon, who's does a lot of layout for Arc Dream, was there. And his friend Meg that helped us in the booth was in that game. Yeah, that was fun.
This is Man with a Thousand Faces. I can't remember much about that.
It's a scenario. It's in Oath 21. It's by Richard Becker, who did Dog Will Hunt, this big scenario that is in Oath 18. And, it was interesting. Both of those, if I remember right, both of those were adventures that he submitted well before the Oath came back from its long break.
Dog Will Hunt is ancient.
So,
and it was always right on the edge of graduating into, we have to publish this, and it was always right on the cusp. But you know, the polish he gave it for 18 brought it around very nicely.
Yeah, good. It was on both that and Man with a Thousand Faces. It was an interesting challenge because I got them really, really thoroughly playtested, and they got a ton of feedback from the playtesters, and I sent all that to Richard, and you know, he did a terrific job sort of adapting and expanding those scenarios based on the playtest. And that wound up making both of them a lot larger than they were originally supposed to be. So they both went way over our ostensible word count limit on scenarios. But it was worth it because the work he did polishing them up and perfecting them was tremendous. And, you know, it was interesting because from his perspective, you know, he wrote these years ago, you know, and he said that to me that it feels like people's expectations on Cthulhu scenarios seem to have kind of changed and evolved with time, where he was sort of writing them as a very sort of skeletal kind of framework approach without a lot of details. And he wound up adding a lot more to them based on playtester feedback. And that took a lot of work, but it seems to have paid off. I mean, with 1,000 Faces, in every review of Oath 21 I've seen, that's been the one that people have highlighted and said how great they think it is. So it's a very cool 1920s scenario.
Cool.
And it's, let's see, what else? In Oath 21, Scott Glancy did a new directive from A Cell about, for Delta Green, about tradecraft issues in your role-playing games.
It's really more of I hate to say it, but it feels like that article, it's kind of incomplete because it's kind of a wind-up for the article that's going to be in Oath 22.
Yeah. Scott, you and I kind of went back and forth on that article for a long time, trying to figure out sort of what direction
And it just needed to be pared down. It couldn't cram everything into one article. We were going to have to break it up into the first part, which is, you know, sort of the gaming part, and then, you know, the second one, that'll be in Oath 22, will sort of expand those tradecraft ideas into something like a list of things not to do.
Right. Well, having seen the sort of the draft in progress of that, it's really fun. In Oath 22, the directive is going to be, if you're going to stick with this title, it's Alphonse's Axioms for Agents. It's a sort of riff on Roger's Rules for Rangers, which is this amazing sort of document that came out in the 18th century in the French and Indian War for to guide, volunteers and skirmishers.
It was asymmetrical warfare in the 18th century, and right. It was all sort of revolutionary ideas at the time. And you read, and even today, you read it, and it's like, if you could actually read Roger's Rules for Rangers and commit them to your, you know, to actually be able to live and breathe those rules, you would make a decent infantryman just from those rules.
Right.
Just having that down pat. You would not be a burden on the rest of the people around you. They're very good. They broke them out again. They broke them out a number of times in fiction. And one of the more recent ones was in that TV show Jericho that got about a season and a half. That was the rules that they got everyone in the local town militia to sort of try to commit to memory, to try and have something like a organized militia for the town. But the axioms for agents, I guess I'm using it because of Roger's Rules, it's incorporating a lot of stuff, including bits and pieces of actual tradecraft and some of the CIA's unofficial Moscow rules. But the thing about all those things, like, you know, and I've dug through things like that Al-Qaeda. There's an Al-Qaeda tradecraft document that was picked up by the British after the bombings of the subways and the buses. It was picked up, I want to say, in Manchester, and it was it's translated and it's available on the internet. You can read it in English. You know, anything that you pick up on tradecraft, you know, that's sort of documented. It's always very specific for what that group is trying to accomplish and what the operational environment they are living in. So, trying to adapt those things directly to Delta Green is kind of a problem because. Different sets of goals and different sets of environment. And so those things can inform, you know, the axioms, but they can't, you know, not everything transfers over. My favorite being the Roger's rule about, you know, fire when they're less than 30 yards away and then, you know, rush out with your hatchet and finish them off. And
right.
I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking when it comes to supernatural critters, shoot them from a very great distance because if bullets aren't going to work, you're going to want to know when they're hundreds of yards away, really. You know, you're going to know that that's not working when you've still got time to run and get in the car and escape.
Well, you can save that, turn that one around and save it for the directions for deep ones. You know, hit the agents with the wither spell first and then run up with your claws.
Exactly. Oh my God, I've suddenly forgotten Forrest James's code name, but isn't that a D? Darren. Darren's directives for Deep Ones. That'll be a whole list of ways to kill Deep Ones, starting with, step one, depth charges.
Right. Do you have a nuclear warhead?
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be one of those flow charts.
Right.
Yes, good,
So that's coming up in Oath 22, right?
Yeah, the axiom.
So let's hit some more things that are in 22.
One thing I noticed is Die High, a cross-platform modern-day scenario by Greg Stolze, and I recognize that because I play-tested that weeks ago without knowing who wrote it because you took the author name off.
Right.
And I wonder how is it – has it changed since the play – because we recorded that, and I'll post that on the Oath whenever actual play podcast when we get closer to having the issue out. But has Greg changed much since the version I looked at, or
I have no idea. I haven't gotten it back from him yet.
Okay. Because I don't know if it's how much do you want me to say about it, because I love the idea of the scenario is great. I think there are some problems with it, but it's kind of hard to say what those problems are until I see.
Well, obviously that's problems with the pre-playtest draft of it, which is the whole point of the playtesting is is you find things that the author didn't think about, that happens all the time. I mean, Greg is a masterful game designer, and he's been doing Ace work for years. He can still overlook things. So that's why we play test stuff even by writers whose work, I can trust implicitly. And if you don't play test it, then stuff like that creeps in.
Let me just point out that, speaking of play testing, the scenario that, Ross, that you played, the Belgian scenarios, the Shadows of Louvain,
yes.
Play test with you went great. It was awesome. The playtest I ran with Blair Reynolds ended early because his character decided to eat the clues partway through the scenario. There was a journal with a bunch of clues in it, and then rather than let the journal's clues be revealed and sort of direct the players towards the problem, his character just began tearing the journal up and eating it, which I admit was not something I anticipated prior to playtesting.
Scott, I'm just wondering, thinking back on our long history, has there ever actually been a useful and successful playtest involving Blair?
That's not a good answer.
I'm thinking.
I just remember just endless series of rolling clusterfucks around betrayal and paranoia and false assumptions and mistakes and it's just one long giant shit hitting the fan.
I will admit that if the scenario can survive Blair's participation, then it is clearly a robust scenario. Having Blair in the scenario is like driving your new car into a brick wall at 70 miles an hour. It's rough on the dummies, but, you're going to learn from it. I'm not saying you're not going to learn from it. But, yes, the most recent one was a scenario where and I admit I picked it out because it involved two things that Blair is completely squicked out by: women and spiders. And halfway, once he finally got the clues about what the problem was, finds the academic who has all the answers and is telling him about the horrible mythological creature. And here, let me open up this, Japanese 17th century illustrated guide to, it's something like the Parade of the Night Demons, which is an actual Japanese book of illustrated. It's a freaking monster manual from 17th century Japan. And he starts pointing out what the problem is. Blair actually became so unnerved by the descriptions that he just stopped listening and said, "We leave. We get up and we leave. We don't listen to him anymore." And he's just about to get to describe all the crap the monster can do.
Right.
What its abilities are, things that he might need to know if he's going to go up against it. And he was so horrified, he didn't want to hear anymore, and he's left. So when it was time to confront the monster, you can guess how it went.
Right.
It went not well. But yes, there have been some, again, some troubles, some stresses. I'm trying. And certainly, there are ones that he has that have not exploded. But those are sort of, he play tested that armored train scenario I was going to run, that Tom wants me to run at Gen Con sometime soon.
Yeah.
And nothing happened. At no point did that go off the rails. He was there for a couple of the. He went through some of the World War Ones, like the Zeppelin one that you played in, Ross and Shane. And he also managed not to explode Dig for Victory. So, but the ones, the problem is that the disasters always stand out because they're so glorious. I mean, again, rules for fiasco for Call of Cthulhu. You don't need those; just need Blair. You will have your fiascos.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I think I must have just, selectively edited my memories to only retain the gigantic clusterfucks that Blair instigated, because they were the most entertaining. It's true.
The biggest clusterfuck, though, that I have all time still is, the chaplain story, and he didn't instigate that. He's just the guy who stood there with his mouth open while his players went completely off the rails.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyways, enough of the esteemed Mr. Blair Reynolds. let us move on again before we get too distracted.
Oh, yeah. So Die High, Greg,
I just describe the basic premise of it real quick? Because I love the basic idea of it.
Yeah.
The basic idea is that there's a monster going around picking off people that are above a certain elevation in Chicago. And the monster...
Woo!
The monster is this flying ethereal thing that's basically invulnerable, except to one thing. It when it grabs somebody to basically infect them or lay its egg in them. Basically,
by the way, possible spoiler alert.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, this is the free play test version, so we don't know if this will do. Before it goes, when it grabs a victim, it holds on to them, but otherwise, it's invulnerable. It's sort of intangible. But it will be killed if it goes below a certain elevation. And so it's in Chicago, and so the only people that are really victim to it are people that work above in the skyscrapers, iron workers or people that hang out on the roofs for parties or base jumpers. And that's the basic idea of the scenario, is how do you kill something that can only be killed if you drag it down? So I love the idea of a monster that is – invincible except for one thing that you wouldn't think of. And so we had some fun with that when we were playtesting it.
Yeah. So if you're listening to this podcast, you know how to beat the monster now. So
well,
make sure you're the one to
test version.
Shane, put the big spoiler alert in front of that.
Send a note to Greg saying, can you revise this and the next 4,000 words?
Well, to be fair, the people who are listening to this podcast are probably game masters, not players.
Yeah, but it's a very cool concept, and he has a lot of really cool sort
what's
of
what's Adam Gauntlet got for us for Guy Fawkes Night?
It's the adventure is called Remember, and it's a Trail of Cthulhu scenario, and that sort of starts off with a suspicious murder in London in the 1930s of a London bookseller that's known to the players, and then there are these kind of random but very suspicious fires that start erupting, and they kind of have to follow the trail of horrible things going on to figure out what's what. And that's another one that is just loaded with some really, really great deep kind of period detail. Adam Gauntlet has written a ton of things for The Oath in its new incarnation. And he's really sharp, and he's very good at kind of, even in the very short pieces he's done, Tales of Terror and Mysterious Manuscripts and whatnot. He's really good at kind of keying in on specific, very evocative details and having those inform the story or the scenario idea. And this is definitely one where that's the case. So it's sort of, it's all about kind of urban 1930s, London, and, there's street gangs, and there's Indian immigrants, and the whole Indian subculture is really, really prominent. And it's cool. It's interesting. It got some really great feedback from the playtesters, and he's banging away on its revision for its final draft right now. So that's specifically a Trail of Cthulhu scenario. Whereas Die High, Greg wrote it with notes for using it for a lot of the different systems.
Is Remember related to Bookhounds, the campaign setting that for Trail of Cthulhu?
It works best if it is. It doesn't have to be, but he wrote it kind of with that in mind because it's it deals directly with the bookseller, and if you've got players that are in the Bookhounds campaign and they're London occult creepy booksellers, then there's your intro right there, and it'll be really easy to give them a motivation to follow all this horribleness around.
Okay, cool. Do we have anything to say about Daniel Herm's article, or do we just announce that it exists?
John, do you read through that article in detail, didn't you? What did you come away from it with?
Yeah, he had some good thoughts in there, just about how, especially how across like session to session, you start kind of paying attention to what's going on, looking for opportunities to add, kind of ongoing complications and so forth over time. It's good stuff. It's kind of a nice way to rethink your campaign especially if you're just kind of going from published scenario to published scenario. It's a good guide to kind of rethinking what you're doing and getting some more interesting and kind of more character driven stuff in there.
Yeah. It's a feature on sort of building a long term campaign and yeah. So it's cool. Dan's a smart cookie. A ton of reviews and the agents.
Yeah.
And Tales of Terror, Arcane Artifacts, Mysterious Manuscripts, and whatnot. So it's gonna be a good issue. And we've got a new artist who's on board, bear with me for just a moment.
Well, I also noticed your Unspeakable Oath submissions policies have updated. So if you're wanting to write for the Oath now, then now is a better time than ever. Especially if you want to try something short, the Message in a Bottle pays a flat $100 for 700 words. No more though.
Seven. It's basically 400 to 700 is kind of our sweet spot. Any shorter than that, and it's not
doesn't fill a page.
You're going to leave a lot of white space. So it has to be. That has to be an extra compelling small amount of words, But then again, that one doesn't pay by the word. So if you've got a thing that just knocks my socks off, and it's very small, then I'll use it. But
conciseness is tricky in horror. Trying to get something very scary in a very short amount of time.
Right.
Well, the best stuff is the shortest stuff. I'm always happier with short stories than novels necessarily with horror. Usually I am. It's the stuff that delivers its impact within a couple thousand words. Yeah, that hurts.
Yeah, the Message in a Bottle is always really challenging because it's so small. It's supposed to only be a one page story or segment or flash fiction or whatever. And ideally it sort of keys in on some really specific themes as well. So while I get a fair number of submissions for it, and some of them are not too bad.
But it's got very exacting requirements.
And I would really love to get more, because I haven't. And part of this is that my own tastes in horror are kind of pissy and specific.
That's right. That's why you're the editor, sir.
so I want it, but that's why I'm knocking the rate up on that a lot.
Yeah.
So per word, that's like ridiculously higher than all of everything else we do in the Oath. But it's such a specific, hard to accomplish thing that I hope that people will kind of spread the word among their writer friends who do Cthulhu-y stuff.
Well, I'll have to take a shot at that.
Maybe we should consider contacting Ross Lockhart and some of the guys, some of these people that he got a hold of through the two books of Cthulhu. A lot of these writers turned up in at the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festivals in the last couple of years, and it's a pretty interesting, you know, stable of writers. There's a lot of good people, Cody Goodfellow, and a guy I really got to do a shout out for is Laird Barron. I don't know if you guys have read any of Laird Barron's stuff, but he has a couple of things. I've only read two things so far, but now I'm going to have to scramble around and find the rest of it. He wrote a rather ghastly thing for both Book of Cthulhu 1 and 2, but the jewel is in Book of Cthulhu 1, which is called the Men from Porlock, which is just an amazingly well put together Cthulhu short story, and can't say enough good things about it. But yeah, they've got a real interesting stable of writers, many of whom are out here in the Northwest area. And any one of talk to Lockhart, and I'll bet you 700 words for $100 is not terrible, and there'll be plenty of people who'll take that on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I hope so. I want to encourage some really good writers, because that's, I think we have it. I think it was that's sort of an untapped opportunity, you know, is to use the sort of bookend of the magazine as a really good kind of a gut punch of a short story. That's what it needs to do.
Plus, I always enjoyed the previous ones. I always like that. Flipped ahead to read those. So
cool.
So this Cthulhu Mythos Encyclopedia thing in a bob. Yeah. Tell us about that, Mr. Ivy.
That's by the illustrious Dan Harms again, and he put it together 10-15 years ago originally for Chaosium as the Encyclopedia Cthulhiana, and Chaosium did a couple of editions of it, and then they parted ways, and it went out to other.
Elder Sign Press, I think.
Yeah, Elder Sign Press has the most recent one. So it's been in print for a long time, and it's just an absolutely brilliant resource if you're trying to do any kind of research and look up the just gritty details of what has been done with this entity or that character in the bulk of the Cthulhu Mythos story.
And shockingly free of a lot of spoilers. He did a very nice job of documenting details of characters who appear in stories like Joseph Kerwin or, Charles Dexter Ward or some of these characters, and still managing to, giving some facts, still managing to not blow the story completely.
Right, right. So it's one of my favorite things ever. So I reached out to Dan a while ago, and we worked out a deal to put together an ebook edition. And Elder Signs wasn't working on one, and he was really interested in doing it. So we got it all cleared up with everybody and put it together. So it's very cool. It's available on Kindle, on iPad, and iPhone. Through the iBook store, for the Nook on Barnes and Noble, and if you want to have a copy that you can download and not have to worry about Apple or Amazon yanking your rights to it at some point if they get mad at you, you can get it from Drive-Thru Fiction. So it's cool. You can download it, and if you want to know exactly where in that giant book there's a reference to, Yogg-Sothoth or whatever, just type that in the search box and you've got it right there. It's great. And that by itself is a lot of fun. I put up a couple of screenshots a few weeks ago of something I did exactly with that, with doing a word search of Yogg-Sothoth and looking at sort of the excerpts from the book where the word is mentioned, and just looking at those excerpts a lot of times is just really, really funny and compelling, and can drag you into all kinds of fun, informative reading. It's a cool thing. So that's out there. So go get it.
I use it every time I'm working on a scenario.
Yeah,
I mean, simply every single damn time.
Yeah,
because it does a good job of directing you to the original stories. That the work appears in, throw that together with the bibliography and concordance or some of the bibliographies online, which will direct you to where a certain short story has appeared and been published. That's very handy for tracking down the original material very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So so that's out there, and we're really happy with it. And we've got, let me see, Dennis Detwiller is working on a campaign called The Sense of the Sleight of Hand Man. Which
is this is on Kickstarter, and I'm actually a backer. I'm looking forward to it because it's the Dreamlands, and it's just the idea, and it's a full-length campaign. Which I think is interesting. I mean, one, I've never really done much with the Dreamlands when I've run Call of Cthulhu, and two, I've only run one real campaign of Call of Cthulhu, and that was Mass of Nyarlathotep, and that was, you know, a meat grinder of a campaign. There wasn't much for characterization or, you know, deep storytelling. It was like, well, we went from the professor to the KGB assassins, and now we're going to finish this goddamn thing one way or the other, you know?
Yeah. John, what was your Mr. Tynes? There was a point where characters just stopped getting named in masks, wasn't there?
Oh yeah, well no, they always had names, but you know, like eventually you just didn't care anymore what the name was. There's just a set of stats you could just kind of keep on playing your same personality through. So I mean, I fairly quickly, you know, went from like my first character in masks was Razzel Bathbone. Who died about 9 minutes into the campaign. When I was someone handed me a shotgun and I chased a cultist down the alley after the, you know, finding Jackson Elias's corpse. And of course it was a double barrel shotgun. I fired twice and then, well, that was kind of it. And so I don't know, by like character, I don't know, five or six, I just gave up and my next character was named Backwash Bejesus. And I have no idea why. And then he died. And so then I had his cousin show up and his cousin was named Motherfuck Bejesus. And everyone called him Mofo. And that's pretty much where it was at. I mean, it was a great campaign, but you know, we went through a lot of characters.
Yeah. Yeah, so your experience on that, Ross, don't feel bad if it doesn't feel like it really felt like a campaign to you. You know, there wasn't a lot of, don't feel bad if there wasn't a lot of character development.
So yeah. But so Sense is it's a Dreamlands campaign, and it came about basically because, well, we talked about this in a previous
It was originally Worlds of Cthulhu link scenario.
That's right. They put the first part of it in Worlds of Cthulhu a few years ago, and
They stopped.
So it originally came out basically because, you know, Dennis had kept hearing so many people say that the Dreamlands didn't seem like a very scary place for Call of Cthulhu games, and it didn't really seem to fit, you know, and he wanted to make it scary.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah.
I was always very pleased with it when he was kicking the idea around. I always loved that he was going to do something with drug addicts, guys who are adult, sort of drug-addled people whose, you know, their waking world was this miserable grind of get to the next fix, you know, and then when they drift into the dreams, they could be something else, or they would be in another world with another set of nightmarish problems. But there's a lot of that in Lovecraft. There's a lot of that in Bob Howard. He's got there the drug use aspect to escape the nightmare of the waking world, and it just hasn't shown up in very much lately. In my humble opinion, that just hasn't been tapped. And when years ago, when he was first kicking that idea around, I was like, oh yes, thank you. Absolutely. You know, that's exactly what I wanted to see. And and everything that's happened with since the Sleight of Hand Man, as it's developed, I've been very happy with. I've been very impressed.
So I'm excited about it. He's run the campaign. I think he said three times all the way through. And he's sort of on the tail end of art and writing on that. And then I expect in a few weeks I'll get the manuscript and start going after it as editor.
When the Kickstarter was run, it was said that it was only going to be available through the Kickstarter campaign. Has that changed? Is it going to be available through Arc Dream, or has that?
I think so. I don't remember. I don't remember the back and forth he had. I know he's interested in making it available eventually for other people. And I think it ought to be, because it's awfully good, and it would, you know, I guess my attitude is, if you were a backer of it and you're upset that other people are going to be able to get it, then, you know, we will gladly give you your money back and apologize.
I don't think the exclusivity is going to necessarily.
I don't think that was the selling point for.
Yeah.
A lot. I mean, it may have been. I mean, there may have been people out there who are thinking, you know what? If I don't get it now, I will never get it ever, and therefore they got it.
Or more importantly, I can't be happy with my copy of Sense of the Sleight of Hand Man if I know other people have it.
Yeah. But you know, the more I've seen of it, the more I think, you know, it would just be kind of stupid to not put it out there and do more with it because it's awfully good.
Well, I'm thinking about running it for the RPPR Actual Play podcast at some point. I know every time we run a game, there are people that want to get that game, whatever it is. So I want to be able to, like, hey, buy that book. Go ahead.
Right. Yeah. So, we're, you know, that's the plan now. I mean, obviously, once we get it together, it's going to go out to all the Kickstarter backers first, and that process is going to take, I mean, it usually takes a few weeks or a couple of months, depending on delivery times. So that's going to happen before we do anything else. Before we do anything else with it. And then we'll look at, you know, at sort of broadening its access.
Fair enough. And he's also doing some paintings for Delta Green right now, too, so I guess he's very busy.
Yeah.
Not just his day job.
Yeah. He's like a creative director at Nickelodeon Games in San Francisco, so apparently he's not busy enough.
Yeah.
But if you go to the Delta Green website at deltagreen.com, down at the bottom, there's like a portfolio section of art, and the most recent dozen or so pieces are paintings color paintings that he's been doing for in advance for the role playing game that we're putting together, and it's very neat. He started doing that after Gen Con because we had a lot of conversations at Gen Con. He and I did, and we did with Scott there, with Greg since he's heavily involved in the development, but Dennis and I talked a lot about the challenges in putting the art together for that and making the assignments and getting artists on board for it and really, really getting people who are going to just perfectly fit what we're trying to do with the game. So the most important thing that he saw that he needed to do was start doing some of that work so that we can use it to kind of show people flat out, you know, what tone and what style we think really works with the game, and that'll help enormously when we need to reach out to some other artists and bring them on board to finish the thing. So that new stuff is really cool. It's very, very fun to look at.
Cool.
And then on the role playing game front, I recently did an online chat with RPGNet. And the transcript for that, if you go to the Arc Dream website, you can find the transcript for that. The exact address is arcdream.com. I'm not going to say it out loud because it's a bunch of gibberish because it's a crazy WordPress web address. But if you go to arcdream.com, look for Delta Green or something and you'll find it.
Well, there'll be a link in the show notes on the website, Unspeakable. So just go to the show notes.
Right. I talked a lot about what we were doing in the, game and our approach, the approach that's sort of developed, over all of our conversations internally with the design team, over the last couple of years and the shape that it's taking.
So, Scott, you had Bumps of the Night finally out in the wild, I guess.
Yep. It has all been delivered to all of the we had over like 300 pre-orders and folks who had bought it at Gen Con or ordered it through the Kickstarter. And at the moment, we only had three copies that came back. Some folks in Norway and Costa Rica. Theirs came back, and we worked out the screwed up addresses and sent them back out again. However, I will say, if your name is Lawrence Krumsiek, spelled Krumsiek, from Northridge, California, all of your contact information is a dead end, and I'm sitting here with your book, and you paid for it, and it needs to go to you, Lawrence. You need your book, all right? You know, so I'll be putting that on the Pagan Publishing News website, throwing it at
that's one way.
Throwing it up on yogsothoth.com, because everything I've got for him is a dead end, and that's no good. So we'll be fixing that soon. But we've all the books are out. I just sent the first pile of books off to Arkham Bazaar. They now have theirs for direct sales, and Alliance has gotten their shipments now. Has gotten to the Alliance game distributing warehouses this week, and will be on their way to retailers soon. So it's getting out into the world now that we know that all of the people who pre-ordered and kickstarted got it before the distributors and before the retailers. Mm-hmm. We've just started playing the gaming. There was this thing where one of the $300 level people could buy 12 hours of role-playing games, gaming with me through Skype or whatever. And my November and December are just packed with people who are going to be playing these games. I've had the two games so far I've been in England and Belgium. Gaming
different groups. Time zones. So
yeah, and you know, the other things, Dave, let's see, I've got a gaming group in the Philippines. That's the one I'm really looking forward to. There's a group of programmers in Manila who bought some time. And there's some guys at the U.S. consulate in the Seychelles Islands that apparently will be Skyping in a game of Call of Cthulhu as well. And everybody wants Delta Green. I keep trying to sell the Belgians on doing the scenario that you did, Ross.
It's set in Belgium.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, it's in Belgium, and then you can tell me everything I did wrong with it, you know. And
the get your playtesting through that.
Yeah, well, that's like the Filipinos. We just had this scenario set in the Philippines. And I'm a couple scenarios that John Crowe put together that said in the Philippines. I'm like, oh, great, we can try it on the Filipinos, and they're like, nah, we don't want to be, you know, there was stuff set during World War II during the occupation and stuff set during the Moro War in the turn of the century. And they're like, nah, we want sunglasses and cool suits and machine guns and satellite phones. And we want the whole Delta Green thing. So, all right. So they're getting Delta Green. But anyways, yeah, it's kind of cool to have all these, you know, to have these, you know, sort of open up the gaming groups with this sort of global look at people who are interested in the game. So that's going on for these 2 months. Pat Harrigan, who did the what's it called, the first person, second person, third person literary collections, have contacted me, and I'll be running a game for them in Madison, I think it's Wisconsin, Madison. Mm-hmm. So that's cool.
He's done stuff on the Oath.
Yep. So that's very cool. That'll be getting done over the next couple of months, and so we will finally sort of shut down and satisfied all of our promises for our Kickstarter just in time to be. We will probably be doing a Kickstarter sometime in November. To get a soft cover version of Targets of Opportunity out. And I just have to work out with Shane how much money I have to pay him for the layout and with the artists and authors. And then we'll have a number to shoot for on the Kickstarter. And that'll probably be happening very, very soon. Yes, actual play on the list of things to announce, that we're going to put up the Shadows of Louvain actual play, played not by Belgians, but by Ross Payton and most of the crew from RPPR.
Well, some of them and some of your who else was there? There were quite a few people there.
Oh, that's right. There was my friend Terry Duba was playing the psychologist in the group. Unfortunately, we lost Jared Wallace partway through. But then again, it was 5 hours.
I understand. Closer to six, actually.
Yeah. So. And you have no idea how much I had to accordion press that scenario down into a format that would work in a con scenario. It was a bit.
Yeah, it's really a three-session game, judging from the amount of material in it. It sounds like something you could really stretch out to 9 or 12 hours easily. judging by the amount of investigation we had to go through, and you telling us you were compressing it. That's going up on RPPR Actual Play on Halloween itself. So that's, I know people have been looking forward to it, so I figured that would be a good occasion for it. So, and also speaking of Kickstarter, which you mentioned a little bit ago, I have, this is slightly off topic, but I have my own Kickstarter going on, Base Raiders, a superhero RPG based on a Wild Talents originally based on a Wild Talents campaign, that sort of mutated into its own beast now. And essentially, it's a take on the superhero genre where all their bases have been abandoned. All the heroes and villains are gone. So people break into these headquarters, lairs, hideouts, and steal all the stuff. And,
Avenger Tower, the Fortress of Solitude.
Yeah, the Batcave, and that kind of thing. So it's a someone described on RPG.net described it as a mercenary version of the comic Planetary, which I love. And so that's going on right now. And I just want to mention that in case you're interested about
shameless self.
Yeah. So
and moving along, let's see, we on our list of things to blab about, Cthulhu World Combat. I want to make sure we get that in.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
But Sandy Peterson's doing a Kickstarter for a sort of a, what, Cthulhu meets Civilization. So it's
fun. More like I would say a little like XCOM and a little like Shining in the Dark and some Final Fantasy Tactics was how I was looking at it. The sort of turn-based squad tactical combat RPG.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how what I saw on the little video, it seemed to be more strategic in terms of
More like playing Civilization, where you're sending out your squiddy things to build nests and, you know, take over territory. And you play instead of playing the Zulus and the Romans and the, you know, whatever, you're playing the fungi from Ny'gath, or you're playing Cthulhu's spawn of Cthulhu, or you're playing some Shub-Niggurath spreading its thousand young across the world.
Yeah. So apparently, in addition to inventing Call of Cthulhu and the video game Doom, Sandy was also heavily involved in the Civilization computer games. Which I did not know.
Well, that's where I first met him, because Bob Krueger was kind enough to get me into an opening party for when Microsoft was launching Age of Empires.
Yeah, and it was the Age of Empires like World Championships or something or other. They were in Seattle.
And, Mr. Peterson was there, but Tynes had met him before. Tynes had met him at he'd run some games at a con that you'd been at. That's where you'd bumped into him the first time.
Yeah, before Pagan, I played in a game he ran at Gen Con, because every year Chaosium would do kind of a big fan event and have a trivia contest kind of thing, and I managed to win a seat at a table ran by Sandy, which was really good fun. And he killed all of us, and it was a good time.
So, considering the pleasure I've gotten out of his, you know, everything from all of his games, I'll be throwing money at Cthulhu World Combat, or at least making a pledge. He's got pretty realistic monetary goals. $300K for a casual game seems believable. I've seen people cite really low numbers that, you know, there's no way they could produce a game if they made their goals.
But. Yeah, I suspect that a lot of times when they're putting in those really low numbers for things like video games, the theory is either number one, you know, me and my friends will do it all for free, you know, most of it. Or number two, if we, you know, look at the vast success these other things have, all we have to do is set it low enough to meet its initial goal, and then that'll generate enough momentum to take it up into the stratosphere.
Yeah,
right.
The challenge always is you know, whether you can actually get to that stratosphere or not. And there was just in the last couple of weeks, there was a kind of an infamous situation came up because a Kickstarter-funded game has tanked because the goal that they set for themselves, even though they achieved it, was nowhere near what they actually needed to create the thing.
Yeah.
Oh, are you talking about Haunts, the video game?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I actually put into that too at the $5 level because I figured, yeah, $5, why not? Right. And there's sort of a happy ending. Ever since he put that request, he's had dozens of programmers offering to help, and apparently he's going to open source it or something, or it's going to get finished.
Good for him.
I think the thing was, it wasn't even he got the money. He just underestimated how much it would cost, how long it would take to finish. So his programmers quit on him. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't even it was just a project management thing where
the number was just so low. It was $25,000.
Right. Well, the game itself wasn't that technically, like, it was partially already done. It was just sort of in theory, just to push it over the end.
Okay.
So it wasn't like from scratch, because they already had a working or alpha when they started it. So it was a matter of, pushing it along, I guess. So some of these Kickstarters, I mean, again, you're not investing in it. You're only getting a product. You're not getting profits from it. So some of these Kickstarter games I know are being, like, they have private financing, and then they just use this as a sort of pre-order system, and it's very complex how people are doing it now. It's very interesting. Yeah. Anyway. We forgot to mention The Devil's Rock, which a New Zealand horror World War II movie that Dennis Ditweller won't like. Is that right?
That was my take on it. I watched it, and it's got a terrible piece of cover art on Netflix. It's like some hot chick half wearing a Nazi uniform covered in blood with sharp teeth. And I would like to point out that never happens in the movie. At no point are there hot Nazi vampire chicks, but it's New Zealand commandos working for the SOE going ashore in the Channel Islands to do some deception raids to make the Germans think that the British are invading the Channel Islands rather than Normandy. It's part of that deception prior to D-Day, and they stumble into this thing where the Germans were doing a supernatural experiment on the island, trying to summon some unearthly, horrible creature from beyond. And they're doing it on occupied territory. So if it really goes wrong, the only people who are going to suffer are going to be the locals. And it'll be British territory. And it's surrounded by water. So, it cannot cross running water. And they call up something horrible. And it's all, very Christian mythology critter. But it's all set inside a big concrete, coastal defense emplacement with these tunnels filled with, these caged light bulbs. It's all poured concrete, bunker, these sort of bunkers, control and command rooms in it. And it comes off very much like Dennis Detweiler's Night in Water, which is the World War II commando raid story he wrote for Dark Theaters, which you can now purchase as a PDF. Here's the shameless plug, off of DriveThruRPG and DriveThru or One Bookshelf. It was a really excellent short story, and this definitely has a feel like it. I mean, obviously, there's no Lovecraft in it necessarily. They name drop Nyarlathotep during a demonic invocation. The great old ones are mentioned as a failed attempt by this Nazi, occult division, to gain supernatural power. It's kind of thrown out in passing. Probably just the writer just gleefully getting to, woohoo, I got to mention the great old ones. And there is a sort of a feeling like, I always remember, what's his name? Stuart Gordon talking about when he was trying to shop Dagon around, and he'd say, okay, there's this, the village is overrun by semi-hybrid aquatic undersea creature cultists, and the money people at the studios would go, what if they were vampires? Yeah, what if the whole town was vampires? Have you considered that? Or maybe werewolves, And it was like, well, they don't get it. And part of me, watching this movie, it's like, because they name drop Nyarlathotep, because they mention the great old ones, I wonder if perhaps they originally threw it out as a Lovecraftian story, and then, because the people with the cash thought, well, no one's going to get that. You better make it the devil. You better make it a straight, easily accessible mythos like Christian demonology. Mm-hmm. But they
because going the big tentacly alien monster thing totally failed for Hellboy.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Also, it's more expensive, and certainly the film is micro budget. Mm. You know, it is a micro budget film. But they did a pretty good job with their costumes. They did a pretty darn good job with their sets. The special effects are all right. You know, there's the minimum amount of CGI. The monster is mostly in-camera effects, you know, and it was all right. It was, and whoever did some research and did some nice actual demonology with protective circles and binding the demon in iron, you know, which was right out of John Dee and Roger Bacon. So it's available on Netflix, folks. So it's worth 90 minutes of your time. It's actually I don't want to oversell it, but I highly recommend anyone who enjoys kind of the whole, you know, Karatekia thing from Delta Green to take a look at it. And certainly in a lot of ways it plays out like a con game. You know, although the cast is very small, there's only like four or five speaking parts in the whole thing. Yeah. But yeah, you put the guys down, the team down in the isolated locale with the horrible supernatural problem, and it's very good. I think keepers and players will enjoy it.
And if you wrote Night and Water, you're gonna feel a twinge.
Yeah, Dennis will probably feel a slight twinge, but it is not the first time that has happened to him. It really isn't.
Yeah. All right. Well,
moving along to our questions, I guess.
You know what? I'll go first. And actually, this is not a question even remotely for John. I believe this is just for Scott. But Wesley James Young on the Delta Green page on Facebook wants to know if you're going to be doing a reprint or PDF of Realm of Shadows.
The answer is yes. We're going to be getting everything out into, not necessarily PDFs, but certainly on print-on-demand books for some things. John Crow still thinks PDFs are a tool of the devil, mm-hmm. but he likes this print-on-demand thing. The trick is, so that'll be available through drive-through and one bookshelf. The whole catalog is going to be moved towards there. If you are listening to this and you have any experience changing old PageMaker 4 and 6 documents into InDesign, call us and tell me about your reasonable rates. And because right now I got one person working on these conversions because they're affordable. But if you if you're out there and you want to help, contact me at sglancy12@aol.com or that's the best address. My email's still a mess, but sglancy12@aol.com. And we'll talk about whether or not you can help converting these old obsolete book formats into PDFs and other things we can use to do print on demand and whatnot. So yes, the answer is yes. Moving along.
Yeah. All right. And this is a real quick one that probably doesn't need a whole lot of discussion. But Graham Kinnenberg on Twitter is at Kenny Graham. He says to please pass his sincere thanks, that's THX because it's Twitter, to John Tynes, that running Convergence resulted in easily my best, most atmospheric Call of Cthulhu and Delta Green games, end quote.
Well, that's great. Actually, the original, you know, when I first ran Convergence in Columbia, Missouri, back around 91, 92, it was a great game, even in that early phase. And I remember in particular the moment when, and this is fairly obscure, but there's a bit in the adventure where you get a recording, this kind of like weird alien scratchy voice that's kind of hard to decipher. And for the game, I recorded the speech and then modified it in a speech program on my computer and reversed it and slowed it down and whatnot and so forth. And then when we got to that point in the game, I led the players to the computer and we're like, here's the file. See what you can do with it in the program I've got open for you. And so they began dorking around with this software, which they hadn't used before, trying to figure out like, okay, here's this weird sound and we don't know what's going on. And they managed to, you know, reverse it and speed it up and so forth to make it intelligible. And the first time they did, and they hit play, and they heard this metallic voice coming out of the computer at them saying words they can understand, I mean, I think they almost shit their pants. I mean, it's a great, great kind of frisson of feeling at that moment. So it was a great experience for me as well, and I'm glad that other folks have had so much fun with it.
Yeah.
Are those audio files, were they put on the Delta Green website?
You know, I was just looking for that because I don't remember. Because
I remember downloading audio files and I played them. I put them on my cell phone when I ran Convergence a few years ago. And I think I got a pretty similar response from my players. And they did not have a good result in Convergence as well. So.
Yeah, I still have Mission the... I have, if they're not on the website, I have a micro cassette that had that audio that I think John mailed to me like in 1993 when it had first come out, and but I don't know, somewhere along the line I got it because I remember I was in New York at the time in law school, and yeah. And Delta Green was still sort of. You know, it was in that awkward phase of everybody really, really wanting to see the book, but it was still a couple of years out, but nobody knew exactly how far out, and and that was I guess our first iteration of the fans all yelling and screaming at you guys for being too slow.
We are that.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I let's see here, just one second. I think I actually have. I think I actually just found them on my hard drive. Believe it or not.
Oh yeah.
Please, please let this be true.
Yeah. Yep, that's it.
Well done.
No good's going to come from unraveling that clue.
I remember when I played it for my players, they just looked at each other like, the fuck, you know, what have we gotten into? This, right. They don't usually get, you know, the show and tell kind of clues in this. So they were pretty, or the audio visual club in a role playing game. So mission accomplished. Yeah. So
I may have punctuate Convergence. May have told you this when we first spoke a year and a half ago or whatever it was, but Convergence is still my favorite game to have run because it's to this date it's the only game that I've run where afterwards. And I'm talking about months afterwards, I ran into one of the players who went out of his way to tell me that after that game, he had nightmares for days about what happened in that game. That was I was enormously pleased and proud.
Yeah, everybody has that moment where their stomach drops out when they realize they've been drinking the local water and eating the local food. Uh-huh. And there's that reveal that, oh yeah, we're fucked. Holy shit, are we fucked? You know,
remember that plot immunity that you don't have?
Yeah.
My favorite. I think my favorite Convergence story I heard from a player is still when his agents went out to the reservoir and they had their spray that they got from the doctor. What's his face? Right. That turns purple when it connects with protomatter. And they sprayed some teenagers who were, you know, like drinking beer or whatever out there and giving them shit. And it turned purple and the kids were like, what is that stuff? And the agent said, oh, that's under 21 spray.
Oh, man.
If only it were.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no reason to be alarmed, citizen. Go back to sleep.
Well, we're all doomed, but we can't. That doesn't mean we can't have a sense of humor about it. So there's one question from Dan Harms. He asked on Facebook that I'd really like to hear. John, if you had to pick one dream RPG project you never got a chance to make, what would that be?
That would be the my Yellow Sign campaign, which I ran for some months in college way back when during Pagan Jolly days, and was, you know, really loved it, had a great time with it, et cetera. It's kind of like it's almost like a Samuel Taylor Coleridge moment. I had written the first like 8,000 or 9,000 words of the manuscript for that campaign, during kind of like a blazing late night session. And then the next day discovered the file had been corrupted and it was gone. And so, I was so just
much like Carcosa itself.
Yeah, exactly. And I was just so like, you know, unable to kind of muster the will to go back and rewrite that whole chunk again, that I just never did. And so I still have some of the, outlines I wrote for the campaign when I was running it. But I never ended up writing the whole thing. And it was, you know, it was definitely creepy and surreal. And certainly I mined portions of it for various, King and Yellow stuff over the years, but the bulk of the campaign I never did anything with besides the outlines. Yeah. So that's one that I kind of always, I wish I'd actually gotten that out the door at some point.
Is that still sort of a conscious decision that you've made? You're just not going to revisit it?
Yeah, I don't really think so. I mean, my time for creative projects is pretty limited, and I think at this point I'd rather work on new stuff instead of revisiting that one, at least. Mostly because, I mean, that would have been a substantial project. It was a full campaign for Call of Cthulhu for the King and Yellow stuff, and it would just be, you know, it's just more than I think I want to tackle for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Well, you know, needless to say, if you change your mind on that, let me know.
Yeah,
you bet.
Inquiring minds want to play it.
Yeah, no joke.
Yeah, Scott, pick one.
All right, I'll pick one. Let's see here. I was going to actually pick the Steve Dempsey's question: Is miscegenation, or I guess you have to say it with a Southern accent, is miscegenation still the basis for cosmic?
No, he's British.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, but miscegenation is what Southerners seem most. Miscegenation seems to be the thing that Southerners are most concerned about.
Yeah. We're horrified by that.
Yeah. is miscegenation still the basis for Cosmic Horror? And if not, what has replaced it? But I don't know. I'll throw that one at you and see what you do with it.
Brother. Well, I mean, honestly, I guess I disagree with the premise.
That's exactly how I feel, John.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, Lovecraft had some stories along those lines, obviously, with the Deep Ones and with Arthur German and so forth, and even Rats in the Walls. I guess not exactly miscegenation, but, you know, the kind of whole atavistic racial memory and secrets locked in your genetic code and so forth, and all the dire, you know, monster sex your ancestors got up to or whatever. But to me, that was never the core of Lovecraft's, you know, kind of awe and quaking fear at the cosmos. And that was entirely based around there being no volition to humanity's existence, that this whole thing just came about because of its a random accumulation of molecules. And that's really much more central to his thought and his notion of what cosmic horror is. So the miscegenation stuff is great, and it's a fun, weird thing, and certainly plays into some of his fears and his aspirations as well about being, you know, New England gentry and so forth, and his desires to have this kind of, you know, honorable family line, when in fact he had something of a mixed bag in that regard. But I don't think that was the key to his vision of cosmic horror.
I couldn't agree more. All right, it's back to Mr. Ivy.
All right. I'm unprepared. You know,
go with Brett Kramer's first question.
Okay. Let's see. John, Brett says, what is the source of Delta Green's staying power as a setting, as a horror Call of Cthulhu setting?
You know, it's tough to say, honestly. I mean, I think part of it is that at the time it came out, it was sort of the, you know, the American military industrial complex version of the Foucault's Pendulum, the Umberto Eco novel. You know, his Eco's novel was more sort of like a grand synthesis of all of the you know, Holy Grail, Arthur, you know, Merovingian blood dynasty of Christ stuff, all kind of wrapped together into a, you know, a big overall perspective. And I think that we sort of did, to some degree, kind of the same thing in Delta Green with all the, you know, UFO stuff and conspiracy stuff and so on, and the Greys and whatnot and Area 51. And I think that was a, you know, there was a just a real interest in that stuff, you know, like many of us had grown up hearing about that kind of thing over the years. And Delta Green kind of took it all and, you know, kind of shook the dust out of it and put it all together into a really coherent and fairly convincing form. I think also the verisimilitude of it, it always just felt very credible. It was very grounded in the real world, and you could believe that these things were happening and that this organization could exist. I think it also solved one of what I thought was always a fundamental problem in Call of Cthulhu, which is how you sort of had a campaign narrative that made any kind of sense at all. You know, and obviously my earlier examples of playing Master and Alphatep and my characters, you know, Backwash for Jesus and so forth are a perfect case example. And at that point in Pagan's history, I was trying to tackle that problem with the Golden Dawn for the Victorian era and with Delta Green for the modern era to provide frameworks that a campaign could exist in, where you could have characters, you know, new characters come in to replace dead characters and so forth, and have it all feel still coherent and believable, and give them a set of resources and connections and so forth that that could kind of, you know, just kind of help support a campaign and make it not feel, you know, like, you know, we had so many random things where we've got, you know, Miskatonic professors who are trying to fast talk their way past a canny police sergeant at the front desk, and it just doesn't make any goddamn sense, you know. It's just kind of just grating. So I really wanted to try and solve that, and so I think part of why Delta Green was so successful is because it was a great shot at trying to provide that kind of a framework. I think the other thing is just that it has a great sense of this kind of tragic heroism to it. It's to me a very American feeling and very associated with me, with the Old West, you know, the pioneers and the lawless West and so forth. And Delta Green has this great kind of cowboy reputation and so on. And it's that, it's funny, I was just reading this thing about how, the difference between subcultures or like racial groups or ethnic groups, I guess, that were farmers versus, like animal, you know, husbandry people, like, you know, sheep herders and ranchers and so forth. And the idea being that cultures that come out of a strong, livestock background tend to be more honor-based and more violent. Because your livestock can be stolen at any time, and it's out there and in the wild, kind of in wide open spaces and so forth. And so there's a high degree of honor and trust needed, and also the realization that you're isolated. If they're taking your sheep, you've got to kill them right now. Whereas with farmers and more traditional agrarian, you know, kind of cultures, you know, like you can't steal my farm very easily, you know, and so their property rights were a lot more secure, whereas the animal raisers were, you know, had much more unsecure property rights. And so
was this article in relation to, say, cultural conflicts in Africa? Because it sounds like you're describing some of the things that I kept reading about in Africa with some of the tribal wars, that it really comes down to people who are attached to, you know, farming versus people who are attached to herding. Conflicts that come in that way. Was that where this came from? Or
No, actually, it was a presidential election.
Wow.
The whole notion being that the explanation for the South was that the American South had a lot of settlers who came from, and I forget now, like Scots, Irish, you know, sheep herders and the like, whereas the New England and the North came more from English and Scandinavian and European farmers who are more like crops and grain and so forth. And so that the culture of honor and violence in the South was the byproduct of that kind of ranching mentality. And I think you do the same thing when you look at the Old West, right? I mean, that was the Old West was much more about, about gold and killing, but also about ranching and what a big deal that was. And so
the classic Western conflict is the conflict between ranchers and farmers.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think in that, and to loop this back to what we're talking about, you know, Delta Green is a bunch of ranchers, you know, like they're, you know, they don't have any stability. They don't have any settled land or territory they really own. They're just kind of like trying to keep what scant resources they have together. And I think that really speaks to this kind of mythic American quality. And so I think that's also a strong element in Delta Green's endurance.
Yeah, you do definitely see that kind of unique American stoicism, you know, the idea that we're going to save the world even if we really can't save it, and even if we're going to kill everybody we saved the village, we had to destroy the village in order to save it, you know.
Well, yeah. I get how it appealed to our American, I mean a lot of this I translates very easily to our American fans. What I don't get is why I have Filipinos calling me up and saying that they want their Call of Cthulhu game to be set in the Delta Green universe, or the Belgians, or the Brits.
I think it's probably because the mythic American West, you know, the Western movies and so forth are just such a key thing. I mean, frickin' Jonathan Turner, you know, just Jonathan Turner, just an Irishman by way of England, just came out and spent 2 weeks like at a dude ranch, like, you know, roping cattle and shit. And he came all the way here from overseas just to have that experience, you know. And he could have gone anywhere. He could have gone to New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles. And no, he went to Montana and, like, you know, ran around in the dirt with cows.
I keep thinking of you know, how America is peppered with Renaissance festivals, but when you're in Europe, there aren't Renaissance festivals. They have Wild West festivals. That there's all these Germans and Belgians and Frenchmen who are dressed up in their chaps and their 10-gallon hats, and then they ape the myth of the West, while we're aping the myth of, I don't know, giant turkey legs and, you know, a cleavage, I guess, at the Renaissance Festival.
Yes, but exactly. Anyway, yeah. Yep.
I have another question. This is from Brett Kramer by email, and he asks, what part of the mythos is most deserving of rehabilitation?
That's a good one.
So I have my own candidates, but I'd love to hear it from you, John.
Boy, you know, actually, relevant to something we were discussing earlier, I would nominate the Dreamlands, but happily, Dennis Stettwiller is well engaged on that project even now, with his campaign, the Sense the Sleight of Hand Man, which I am looking forward to seeing in finished form here fairly soon. So certainly the Dreamlands is one. And to me, like, there's a key element in the Dreamlands that I don't know if Dennis is going to find, you know, a way to address or not. But at the end of the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, there's that awesome moment when Randolph Carter realizes that the vision of the Golden City he'd been pursuing, you know, all this time was actually just his kind of buried memories of Providence at sunset. And that was like, it was actually his nostalgia for his childhood home that was what propelled him to the farthest reaches of, you know, space and time and so forth. And that's such an awesome moment, and such a, you know, as opposed to Lovecraft's usual twists, which are more like, to cite Mark Rogers' Samurai Cat, the socks were of no human shape. and instead of that, it's more this realization, this epic journey he's made was really just a way to get back to what he loved in his childhood. And it's a powerful moment, and such a surprisingly human moment at the end of so much, you know, strangeness and so forth. And it kind of puts the Dreamlands in a certain perspective in terms of them being, you know, a vehicle in which you sort of journey outwards, but really you're journeying inwards at the same time. And I don't know if that's the kind of thing Dennis is gonna tackle in his take on the Dreamlands, but I can't wait to see what he does with it. So certainly, yeah. I would nominate that.
Yeah, I think that along those lines, one thing about the Dreamlands that sort of rubs gamers, the Call of Cthulhu gamers, the wrong way, and the reason it feels like such a disconnect from the other Cthulhu mythos material is that it's so strange and otherworldly that that it's hard to feel that kind of existential crisis that suffuses all of Lovecraft's normal work. You know, it's not as obviously about the universe does not have a kind and forgiving God, and it's completely out to get you. You're just a speck, and you lose sight of that sense because it's such a grand, huge, strange, magical thing. But ultimately it still comes back to a sense of that same issue, which is, you know, he wasn't in fact pursuing anything that was outside of and therefore greater than himself, but linked to himself, or that he could attain. You know, the best he could hope for was trying to recapture some memory that was completely subjective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Agreed.
Yeah.
And you know, I'll pick a runner up. And this is just one of my personal sort of obsessions. And that's Lovecraft's story, The Hound. Which to me is one of the great works of kind of tongue in cheek pulp horror. And it makes me wish that someone would design a like a little, you know, My Life with Master style indie RPG. It's basically like, you know, more, you know, like a one-upsmanship game between players to see who can be more decadent. Because that whole story is like these two like ridiculously decadent aesthetes who are just, you know, to the point, and let's not lose sight of this, we're in the story, they've constructed an apparatus kind of like a pipe organ in which different keys release different smells into their apartment. Mm-hmm. Smells being like grave rot and, you know, festering organs and so forth. And so they can just like dial up a mood by pushing these buttons and having these horrible scents flow into their living space. Like that's just how crazy that story is.
Right.
I mean, I think it's easy to lose track of how bizarre those guys are, because the plot of The Hound and the key on the skeleton and so forth is kind of front and center. But when you pay attention to what he's writing about there, I mean, like, honestly, like I've known these goths. I've known these people. I've been to their parties. I've been to their houses. I think that's a funny, weird story that is overlooked and probably taken too seriously. And I think there's a fun kernel of a game in there.
Have you read Poppy Z. Bright's sort of rewrite or remix of The Hound?
I have not.
She did one. I think the story is called "Are You Loathsome Tonight?" And it's essentially The Hound, except she goes ahead and, you know, writing as an ex stripper from New Orleans. She recasts our two decadent estates as sort of these definitively fey sort of goth club kids who are looking for the next, horrible, loathsome sort of, you know, thing to sort of spur each other on towards new acts of depravity. And she, you know, definitely kicks out dials the sex and up to 11 during the course. But it feels like, you know, I sort of, when I read it, I always felt that she had the experience you did.
Yeah.
A story to realize that, you know, Hound from Ling, you know, Schling, who cares? Let's talk about these two whack jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
What crazy crap they're up to in their apartment. You know?
Yeah.
It sounds like an easy hack for the old indie free RPG Kill Puppies for Satan. I think you could, you know, rob graves for the decadence.
Wow, Kill Puppies for Satan. All right.
Have you heard of that game?
Oh, yeah.
The premise of the game is you're a Satanist. You're trying to drag people to hell, damn them to hell. So you can't kill them. But what you can do is make the world as miserable and as evil as possible to inspire people to be evil as well. So the idea is you kill puppies for Satan instead of killing them directly. So it's
I got that game came in the mail to me as a manuscript many, many years ago, and I was still running Pagan, and it was right before Gen Con, and I got a copy in the mail, and I don't recall if the guy even had his name on it. Like, it was just this weird manuscript that turned up at my door. But I think he sent it to several other people in the industry, because I got to Gen Con and I began talking about, I got this crazy fucking thing in the mail called Kill Puppies for Satan, and somebody else was like, I got that too, and it was this, you know, weird thing that we talked about at Gen Con that year.
All right, next question. I got to tell you, the question from Paul Sefko on Google Plus is what do you do when the horror in your games falls flat, or how do you recover? And I guess we shouldn't just limit that to games, since John's done a hell of a lot more than games. But it says, what do you do when the horror in your game falls flat, and how do you recover? Personally, John, I've never been in a game that you ran where the horror fell flat. So maybe this is a quick question.
Boy, that's a tough one. Because, I mean, like, so many moments of horror in the games aren't entirely orchestrated. It's more that, I mean, if you're doing it right, they're kind of improvised. Like, you know, and it's basically because the players – so to me, like, horror in a game begins with dread. the players have put themselves out into some kind of, like, they're on a bit of a limb. They're in some kind of risky situation where they're having to be careful, quiet, sneaky, whatever. And they know that there are repercussions to what they're doing, and they don't know what those are just yet. And so they have dread. And once you've got dread established and the players are kind of antsy and tentative and fidgeting with their dice and so forth, you know, that's when you can kind of begin to push them towards horror. And to do that, you know, you've kind of got to gradually crank up the intensity and hopefully begin to do just simple things like separate them. You know, get one player over here, one player over there. Not just their characters, but physically the players. Like, get one guy in the bathroom, one guy in the bedroom, and then go back and forth so that they really have no idea what's going on. But I think that's kind of what you have to do to get there. And then if it's not working, I mean, to me, like, if I was trying to run a horror game and the horror wasn't working, I think I would just go for desperate intensity. You know, just like go ahead and have the axes coming through the doors and the boards being pulled off the windows by the zombies and that kind of thing, and just go for that and try to recover some sensation through intensity and desperation instead. That's kind of where I would go next. And frankly, that's sort of the, you know, have a guy come to the door with a gun kind of moment, right? I mean, you just want to like suddenly like flip the table and like, oh shit, it's all a gun. No, hits it in the fan now. Mm-hmm. And because they didn't expect it, like that's going to generate its own form of outrage and anxiety. And it may not be the horror you were going for, but it will at least, you know, crank up the intensity level, which is good.
Okay. Right. Mr. Ivy.
Yeah, the another one from Dan, Dan Harms, he asked on Facebook. This is kind of an insidery question. I'm asking it because I'm personally really curious about it, and I guess we'll see how much our listeners take away from it. But he wanted to know about the design philosophy with the D20 Cthulhu book that you and Monty Cook sort of spearheaded with help from Scott and Dennis and a bunch of other people. You know, so
yeah.
What was the approach to that? What was your sort of design philosophy going into that?
Yeah, you know, that to me is kind of one of the great I wouldn't call it missed opportunities because I think I'm happy with the result, but just sort of overlooked accomplishments, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that project was one that was very much sort of built separately. Monty did all the rules stuff, pretty much, and he kind of drove all of that, you know, taking Cthulhu, working it in the D20, making the D20 rules work. That was all his part of the project. And at Pagan, we were really concerned with, it was a division of labor. You know, we were doing the advice for GMs, the monsters, you know, the campaign guidance, that kind of stuff. And that was just a thing we agreed to kind of up front that, you know, Monty was a D20 guy. He should do the rules and we'll do the campaign stuff, which was great. And I'm very happy with the result. But we went for something with D20 Cthulhu that was extremely important to me at that point, fairly late in my work with Pagan, which was trying to just pry the cold dead hands of August Derleth off of the mythos. If you look at Call of Cthulhu and how Chaosium had dealt with it, and understandably, I mean, it came out in like 1982, I think it was, or 81. I mean, it was really early in RPGs, so it's natural that they had, you know, here's some rules, here's some combat, here's a bestiary, like the monster manual with stats for characters or for monsters and gods and so on. Like, it's all very understandable. But they didn't really ever kind of turn away from that initial vision, which was very influenced by Derleth's sort of, you know, war between the old ones and the great old ones and the outer gods and all this kind of stuff. And in particular, they just sort of kept accreting things onto it. You know, they kind of wanted to sort of pull in every, like, Brian Lumley's stuff and, you know, and Ramsey Campbell's stuff and Robert Bloch's stuff and all this kind of stuff over time, and just sort of just, like, wedging more of it in there. And because everything they added had to have a stat block and, you know, percent chance to hit and claw bite attacks and whatever else, I think it just continually kind of leached a lot of the what was interesting about Lovecraft, what was revolutionary about Lovecraft from it. And because they had to kind of make it all fit in an RPG sourcebook sort of way, they also had to kind of like make everything conform to a coherent sort of mythology as well. And what I wanted to do in D20 Call of Cthulhu was just to blow that up. I really conceived of that project as this kind of bomb-throwing radical attempt to completely demolish and rebuild Call of Cthulhu from the inside. And I wanted to throw out all of that stuff and all of those assumptions and all that kind of tired approach to gaming. And my goal was really to make the GM, make the keeper, to put the keeper in the role of Lovecraft himself. Where if you're making a campaign for your players, you're not, you know, going to the grab bag of monsters and just putting in, you know, I'm going to have a dimensional shambler and a shantak and this and that and there. But instead, to look at it the way Lovecraft did, you know, I'm going to tell a story about an inbred and diseased family with dark secrets. And given that that's the story I want to tell, what do I need to make that story work? And then, you know, if I can just make up a monster, I can use a monster, whatever. But I wanted to restore that sense of freedom because I felt that Call of Cthulhu had just hemmed people in so much by defining everything. And I wanted to get back to that idea that, you know, Lovecraft didn't start by writing a giant, you know, bestiary of creatures. He just started by having these stories he wanted to tell. And he created stories and created books and so forth on the fly as he needed to accomplish his narrative goals. And I wanted to teach keepers to do that, to just, you know, fuck all the stuff, fuck all the names and all the lists and all the established canon, and just ignore all of that because Lovecraft did. That wasn't his thing at all, you know, and just actually start from the ground up and say, what's a story I want to tell in this scenario we're going to play, and what do I need to beg, borrow, steal, or invent to make it work? So that was my goal in particular that I wanted to accomplish with the keeper advice and so forth in there, and it's why we didn't put stats for the gods in the main rulebook. I just want to get away from the whole idea of Nyarlathotep having, you know, three attacks per round or whatever, because it just seemed so nonsensical. I mean, even, you know, all the times we played Call of Cthulhu straight up, you know, I mean, we never had Nyarlathotep roll to hit. I mean, like, it's kind of pointless. You know, if you've met Nyarlathotep, either he's a plot device delivering some kind of clue or he's taunting you or whatever, or he shows up to rip your head off and make a baby in your ass or something, you know? I mean, that's just kind of how it goes. So the idea that you had to have stats for them was just nonsensical to me. So I really wanted to strip away all of that dross, all of that accreted canon that had gotten so cobwebby over time, and just get back to thinking about your campaign the way Lovecraft thought about his stories, and put you in that mindset and give you that power and that authority to just make stuff up, use things as you want to. Don't worry about trying to conform to someone's idea, to Durrell's idea of a systemic mythos. Now, we had some other goals as well, which Scott and Dennis and John Crowe did a fair amount on in terms of the campaign frameworks. You know, we really tried to pitch a broad vision of Call of Cthulhu that wasn't just the 20s or 30s or wasn't the modern day, but I can't recall how far back we went, but, you know, we really tried to cover decade by decade, basically across the 20th century. And even earlier, and sort of provide a lot of different ways and frameworks you could jump into a campaign with, you know, some kind of reason why the players are together and a reason why they're adventuring and so forth. And just try to kind of bust the game loose from its fairly narrow slices of history that it was exploring. So that was, you know, and I'd say in stepping back a bit in general, our approach was just to try to empower the keeper. I just felt that the groaning bookshelves of products that Chaosium had shipped over the years had just, you know, it's like Marley's chains, you know, in the Christmas Carol. It just was weighing down keepers everywhere and still is to this goddamn day, which drives me crazy. And I really want keepers to just feel that they can jettison all that, put a match to that shit and burn it and just make up your own thing. Because that's what Lovecraft did. Like, he was a revolutionary. And I think that in his spirit, I think every keeper should be a revolutionary in their own campaign.
You know, actually, I've always loved the D20 Call of Cthulhu book because of the campaign advice and some of the information. I'm looking at it right now and looking at the time periods you mentioned. Since you forgot, it starts with the Age of Empires, 1890 to 1909, mm-hmm. And then goes all the way to the modern era. And what I always appreciated was also the nuts and bolts. Do you know who wrote, like, the advice on structuring a mystery scenario? Because I've loaned this book out to people who've wanted to run mystery adventures, and they have used this to create really good scenarios, mystery scenarios.
Good.
So, I mean, from that, just – I in fact, I've, this is the best, one of the best game, gaming books, role-playing games that I've never actually played. I've never played the D20 version of Call of Cthulhu, but I reference it every once in a while. I always loan it out to new GMs who are wanting to run a horror game. Because even not just Call of Cthulhu, just horror in general. There's so much good advice in here. It's just a shame that it's not available. That material isn't more available.
I agree. I've kind of wondered about that a little bit because, I mean, to me, honestly, like all the stuff that we were doing on our side of the project really had nothing to do with the D20 system at all. We were just
We didn't touch the mechanics once.
Yeah, we were just kind of reimagining what would we make Call of Cthulhu if we made it today. Yeah. And I think mine did a great job with the D20 stuff, and it worked out really well for D20 players. But ultimately, you know, the work that we did, I would love to liberate that in some fashion and re-release that, even just as articles online or something, because it's such good material, and I hate to see it kind of lost. And at the time, honestly, at the time, it was fairly dispiriting because the, you know, the reactions we were getting from Cthulhu players were mostly just like, D20, that's right. Nonsense. I'll never play that garbage, this cash-in, fast-buck nonsense. And it was so hurtful because, you know, we really took it on as an opportunity to just like, what if we got to remake Call of Cthulhu without Chaosium? What would that be like? And we really took a stab at it, and I'm very proud of the results.
Yeah, Dennis and I approached WotC, I don't know, probably 8 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, asking about, you know, what would it take to just buy the rights to all of that material from them, and
not the mechanics, just the rights to the just the rights to the other material.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to sneeze at the mechanics because Monty did great work. But we were particularly interested in the, you know, the background stuff that you guys specifically did that Dennis helped with too. But they were not. It wasn't a conversation they were interested in wasting time on.
Yeah, I thought I heard at some point that the rights actually reverted to Chaosium. The Chaosium ended up with ownership of all that material.
That's my understanding too.
Oh, even the stuff you guys wrote?
I mean, it's all WotC owned everything that we wrote, so it was a work for hire deal.
Yeah, right. But that's what I mean is that all went to Chaosium. It wasn't like broken up in pieces.
That's kind of my understanding. I mean, certainly, like, if anything went there, probably everything did. So, yeah, at some point, I want to ping Charlie Crank and see if that's available. If so, I'd be happy to release that stuff for free or anywhere else.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love
to see that happen. It was great. It was really great material, and it was, and I completely agree. It felt like it sort of went, you know, under so many people's radar, just based on the negative reaction, the sort of
knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah, the knee-jerk reaction to or backlash against the D20 boom.
Yeah.
Yep. One thing that also it's you know, a really well-produced book too, hardcover, fully, and the illustrations are just excellent. There's a lot of really good work in here, and it's, you know, I'm looking through again, and there's, you know, the work you did on the artifacts. There's a lot of stuff in here that's not in Call of Cthulhu, like the various projectors and art, you know, alien technologies. And it's a shame that it's kind of, people don't know about it. It's hard to find now. I'm glad I picked up my copy when I did.
Right.
I think it's out of available. Well, because it's a WotC thing now, I don't even know if the PDF's available.
No, it's not, because again, everything reverted back to Chaosium, and they haven't done anything with it because, you know, they. I think possibly because Chaosium, you know, they took their stab at D20. They had some D20 products for Call of, for D20 Call of Cthulhu, some, and they didn't go anywhere. People just weren't interested in them, and the result is that the color material, the stuff on advanced advice to keepers, and you know, setting up and running campaigns, that materials remained marooned because the mechanics were not popular.
That kind of drives me crazy, because if you know, if they own the rights to the entirety outright, then there's nothing to stop them from breaking it up, you know.
Exactly.
And producing
Charlie, if you're reading this, you can republish it, and John and I can't do crap because you.
Well, you know, they're putting together a new edition of Call of Cthulhu that kind of starts from scratch. You know, so good Lord, if you've got that stuff that got that much work and research behind it, then,
and you already own it.
Yeah, that's weird. Going in there, then that weirds me out.
It's free, Charlie. Just think how free it's going to be.
All right. So do we have any more questions you guys want to hit, or do we want to get into the deeper stuff?
There might have been one or two other questions on here that I want to take a quick look at. John actually hit one of the things later, which was later we had Witch Mythos, about picking and choosing from the huge amount of Cthulhu mythos that's out there, and talking about the kitchen sink approach. We kind of hit that, I guess, already. Let's see what else have we got. Is Baby's Day Out the most Lovecraftian film ever made? thank you, Jonathan Turner. That he's so helpful. Let's see here. Anything else? Anyone sees any of these things that are particularly want to get in, or how many more minutes we want to spend on this?
I think we covered quite a wide variety of material. The questions.
Oh dearie. The best story of Pagan not yet told.
Boy.
What is that? Because we've told them all.
Well, actually, well, there's one question I want to know. I just someone else is highlighting. Who is Coens in the Tynes Coens Corporation?
Oh. Yeah, that's
is it Coens?
Cowens. Tynes Cowen Corporation. It's fairly lame. Cowen was my middle name. So in those days, my name was John Cowen Tynes. And when I made the corporation, I just called it Tynes Cowen Corporation. Because at the time, the corporation was just meant to be for paperwork purposes. You know, I figured that Pagan Publishing is how everyone would know it. So I called it Tynes Cowen Corporation. I just reversed the names is all.
We're still doing business as Pagan Publishing, and that's how everybody knows us. But yeah, we're filing our taxes as, you know, Tynes Cowen Corp.
Yeah. Yep, and that's all it was.
I gotcha. Well, that answers the question.
What's your favorite part of DG that you didn't write? Says Scott, fishing for a compliment.
Perhaps the Majestic 12 stuff.
Honestly, I'd like to know what's your favorite part of DG that never got written.
Oh, jeez. I don't know. I mean, we did so much great stuff. I don't feel like we ended up being all that short. I guess I would love to see your goddamn novel, Scott.
Thank you.
Yes, Scott.
Well, at this point, I think we may be taking that novel, chopping it up into so much mince, and baking it into a casserole so that it'll bridge the gap between old-style Delta Green and the new book. And that's what I'm hoping to do with it, because it has been sort of left behind, but I think it can be turned into a nice bridge. We can build a bridge out of it, much like a witch.
Yeah, it's a raft of dead bodies lashed together.
Yeah. thank you. That's everybody's favorite raft.
Medusa, what are you talking about?
Yeah. My favorite part of DG that I didn't write is it's a really great question. I'm actually pulling my first edition copy of Countdown off the shelf. Boy, actually, you know, one of my favorites is right at the front. That awesome report that Scott, that you did, in fact, write about Cell Y in the United Kingdom and how it all went to shit.
Let me point out that I did not write that. I merely reported the facts as they happened.
It breaks my heart to this day to say that I missed that game because I was working a shift at fucking Wacken Hut.
Which is awesome.
Were you at least disposing of witnesses?
If only. No, my I can tell you about my job at Wacken. Most of my work at Wacken Hut was armed security, mostly at truck stops and grocery stores in high risk areas.
Excellent.
And it was the
ooh, scary.
Oh, it was the grocery stores were the scary part, because it was like that. Those were the places where I came the closest to either getting knifed or getting into a gunfight with people. Yeah. Because, you know, it was just these neighborhoods where people were pissed off and were on a you know, there were some customers that were just looking for a fight, you know.
Yeah.
And the big tall you know. The big tall dude who clearly does not fit into this neighborhood, you know, in the rent-a-cop uniform with the revolver on his hip.
Yeah.
So no, I wish I could say, I mean, yeah, okay. I reported what happened, but a group of players who, unfortunately, I don't remember everybody who was involved, but there was
it was Keith Potter and
I believe
Pat Grindel. And there may have been one other. I don't remember if there was.
There were three or four players. Yeah. They had as many as there were in the scenario. I may have thrown in maybe one extra person, but yeah, they went through that and did a great job. What was hilarious is when we were playing it, I'm sitting there with a map of London, you know, and I'm describing where they're going. And at some point, the guys on the other end realized that I actually had a map of London. And then I was naming streets, and you've turned on the – because they were following the car chase that they were in sort of on their own maps of London. Everybody had brought a map of London, presuming that I was going to be that specific. And then
this was an online game on AOL, yeah. On AOL oh, chat. Yeah.
In the ancient misty past when dinosaurs ruled the earth. Great.
That's awesome. You know, the other – looking at Countdown reminded me that the one of the – parts of Delta Green that made me the happiest still is from the files of Dr. Graham Emerson.
Oh, thank God you said that.
Yeah, that's when that ship began to arrive from Graham, I, you know, like that's one of those moments where you just think, wow, you know, I thought I was writing something and it turns out it's all real. And it was so good and so meticulous. And he really just, I mean, he just did a brilliant job. And I was so impressed with his work on that. So that meant a lot to me to see that come through.
Every time he puts out one of those files, frankly, you know, as far as I'm concerned, he could write an entire 200-page book full of these reports.
Yeah, I would happily read that.
And we would bind it up, print it, punch holes in it, put it in ring binders, mm-hmm. And people would buy that shit, you know, with nice yellowed pages, and they're all of them are gorgeous. All you know, all of them did this. He did a great job of telling a story. In a report.
Yeah.
You know, not only did he get his brilliant, you know, technical details of the biology or the incomprehensible biology or chemistry in there without talking down to his audience, he also did this great job of making each one of these horrible dissections or autopsies tell a story, a full story. And excellent work. We want more of that, please.
Yeah. Dennis and I went back to Graham when we were putting Black Cod Island together, and he was he was invaluable in helping to nail down the you know, because Dennis sort of, you know, he wanted to get into a lot of nitty gritty detail about the biology of the deep ones and the different kinds of deep ones that he wanted to feature, you know, he did tremendous work on helping us to hammer that down and make it even even creepier than it was before by dint of making it more realistic.
Yeah, that to me is one of those places where, you know, the fact that we made Delta Green is great, but the fact that in turn inspired this guy to do that work, which so perfectly encapsulates so much of what's great about Delta Green, you know, both the horror and the verisimilitude and all of it coming together and your kind of belief that, you know, as much as Lovecraft described, that, you know, science and technology straining in their respective fields will, you know, open up the peace and safety of a new dark age. Like it's all just kind of right there in those reports. Now they were brilliant. One of my favorite parts of Delta Green.
I hope he's listening to this. I hope his head's the size of a Halloween pumpkin.
Yeah, I do too. I'd love to thank him for that that awesome work he did.
Well, speaking of writing, I think we should. This is a good segue for the interview, since the main topic of this podcast was originally supposed to be Strange Authorities, your new novel. So, can you give the listeners an idea of what it's about?
So, Delta Green Strange Authorities is kind of an omnibus or compilation of all of my Delta Green fiction. So that includes the original Delta Green novel, The Rules of Engagement, as well as my short stories, The Corn King, My Father's Son, The Dark Above, as well as the Reginald Fairfield's Final Report, the original Delta Green book. And it's kind of all in one place. And I've arranged the stories in there chronologically in terms of when they happen in the Delta Green timeline of events and with all the old material, which is good because there's actually quite a lot of overlap across the stories. And so it's great to actually, when I was putting the book together and reviewing, you know, okay, so when did this happen and where was this here? And then realizing all the places where there were threads from one story that I would just kind of brush up against another place elsewhere. Actually surprised myself realizing this in retrospect, how interconnected it all was. And so it's great to have it all together in one book and to have it out there in, you know, in ebook and PDF and in soft cover and hardcover as well. It's terrific to have it all in one place.
Yeah, I've already started reading it, and part of it I've already read the Fairfield's report from the original Delta Green, but I really enjoyed the Corn King. The idea of for me, it's interesting that you had the character, like the main Delta Green and MJ-12 of actually, you know, really talking to each other, because that's not one of the things I would really picture in the Delta Green mythos, is a lot of face-to-face time. It would mostly be into darkness with, you know, silenced firearms.
Yeah.
Well, that was, especially since that, because that was the subject of the Rules of Engagement, that kind of, when things turned to conflict, you know, it was about the conflict and not about the sort of the Cold War. And I think that kind of defined the Delta Green Majestic relationship in a lot of readers' minds, because it was so prominent in that novel.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, having at least an outlier of a story that showed, you know, things going on before Fairfield decided to pick a fight, you know, was kind of intriguing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is fun because, you know, the Strange Authorities, the collection, begins with the Corn King, which is Fairfield and Lepus kind of squaring off there in part of the story. And then, of course, that's kind of where we get to again with Rules of Engagement. We sort of, you know, move through and explore where those guys came from and why they're connected and sort of how what happened in the past with all this stuff. And it is honestly like a giant, you know, just mass of tangled timelines across time and space, some of which are supernatural in occurrence. I was, in putting the book together, I ran across the section in Rules of Engagement where they go back in time to where they're on board the plane over China when they're trying to assassinate Alzis, basically.
Again.
Yeah, exactly. And realizing and remembering, like, oh, right, because that whole thing was based on, I think Scott gave me this.
No. You found that. You found that.
Oh, crazy, I did?
Fucking, you found that crazy fucking civil air transport hijacking story.
Yeah, yeah.
About it was hijacking that went bad and killed the filmmaker, the Chinese filmmaker and his whole entourage, or Burmese, or whatever it was.
Oh, God, that's right.
You found it while doing some research on civil air transport, and it was one of the juiciest tidbits we've ever dug up.
Yeah, that was great, and that was such a and that, looking at that scene again, or that sequence, and realizing, like, oh, right, that came from a real thing that actually happened, and that was sort of got woven in here, but it also is the point at which Agent Shasta essentially kind of gets, you know, sort of like messed up in time and so forth as well, and kind of begins to see the Court of Azathoth and everything else. Like, the whole thing just kind of has this great, fun, you know, sort of fourth dimensional stuff going on that pulls all the stories together in various ways, which is great fun. The other thing that reminds me, that I think of with Rules of Engagement in particular, is I went to Scott, and this responsibility you can't duck, Scott, because I had this idea that, okay, well, they've taken, you know, they've kidnapped kidnapped Shasta or whoever else, and they've got him in at Outlook Group at their facility in America, initially at least they think they do, And so I was like, how do we, you know, the agents know this thing exists. How do they get the rationale for why they can charge in there with their government badges? Like, how do they do this? And you were the one that was like, well, they could have unlicensed medical waste disposal problems. and that was the key that let me bring in the U.S. Marshals and all this stuff to enforce the warrant, because it was like they were doing all this kind of crazy medical experimentation stuff. And so, of course, they had unlicensed medical waste disposal going on left and right. And that was a great example of Delta Green and kind of what it's all about, that, you know, like, okay, we're going to go after these horrible guys from beyond time and space. And to do that, we need a convincing justification for a warrant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a great idea and a fun, and it made for a really great sequence in the book.
I have to admit that it's probably the result of having arrived at Pagan after 3 years of law school.
Yeah, exactly.
We're just like, you know, I'm not thinking, well, we'll just burn the building down and, you know, be done with the problem. I'm thinking, all right, you know, how are we going to lawyer our way into this? Because we're going to need a big giant passel of human flesh wards in the form of, you know, U.S. Marshals, which is really what it came down to, is how do we throw a bunch of marshals between us and the problem? And it worked. It was gorgeous.
Yep.
I always liked that sequence where they kick in the door and they just find the, you know, the fucking Greys standing around the split open Delta Green agent that they're extracting the proto matter from, and it's just like that deer in the headlights moment. Is one of the most satisfying things. Where, clang, the door's open. It's like, okay, kids, this is the payoff. And then it's just all fingers on triggers, and everybody does the dance of death. It was very, very awesome.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was good fun.
And thank you again for having my brain eaten by Nancy.
Well, you know, it was black and hot left, right, and center, so...
You know, it's interesting. It seems a lot of the writing is coming from sort of serendipitous research or collaboration or accidental, you know, getting help from the other people from Pagan. Or what? How often does this happen in your writing? That kind of lucking upon something or getting help from somebody for figuring out some angle or a bit of research, is that sort of uncommon, or does that work a lot in your favor?
Oh, it's so critical. This is Ken Height has a refrain that he often says, which I think more or less I'm recalling it correctly, that when he's doing his, like, this is especially true when he was doing his suppressed transmission column for Pyramid for many years.
Yeah.
And he would say, you know, it's not writing, it's just research. Because, you know, you scratch history and it bleeds weirdness. I mean, it's one of these things that, you know, we live in this kind of orderly clockwork consensual reality of, you know, well, we understand there's gravity and physics and so forth. But, you know, 1,000 years ago, it was like, well, we understand that the world is flat, and, you know, and we're I'm feeling
humorous.
Poor. Yeah, I feel poor today because I have a small dwarf in my stomach. I mean, this is just like people believe this shit 1,000 years ago, right? And so we believe today, but, you know, like, God knows it could be entirely rendered as utter bullshit 1,000 years from now, right? So whenever you scratch reality, that's what you find. You find all these weird places that we just have constructed an entire society based on not looking at those things. We only look at the things that make sense, that are coherent, that can be regulated, and can be driven towards industrialization and so forth. And like, there's weird stuff out there, we have no idea.
The ones that are comfortable.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's a whole different world. So when you begin to do that research, then you realize, you know, just how weird the world really is. I mean, a great example, one of my favorite examples, is when I was doing the Golden Dawn project at Pagan. Obviously, Yeats, William Butler Yeats was an important figure in this. And I was reading up on Yeats and the time period and this and that, and I ran across this concept, this name Sheila na Gig, which in England and in Ireland and Scotland as well, I think, there are on ancient castles and mansions going back from, you know, the Dark Ages, basically up through sort of like the Renaissance to 1700s, maybe, you find these little carvings embedded in walls and especially over archways in churches and castles and all kinds of ancient places in the stone. And it's this figure of a very stylized female figure that's kind of this emaciated human with an outsized head and big eyes, frankly, like a gray. And it's emaciated, and its ribs are strongly delineated. So it's kind of a skeletal figure with huge eyes and this outsized head. And most commonly, the figure has a vagina and is reaching its hands into this kind of distended, protruding vulva and pulling it open.
Cavernous.
Yeah, I mean, kind of like Goatsy, but with a vagina, right? So, and it's a really weird figure, and it occurs all over the British Isles, on all these different buildings across the 1,000-plus years, and no one knows why. No one has any goddamn idea. And there's a few stories around it and so forth, and but it's really super, super vague and ancient.
But they're guesses, and people are guessing it has something to do with old-style fertility cults or old-style harvest or, you know... But
yeah.
there's no definitive answer.
Yeah, there is. No one knows. And at some point, I think in Ireland specifically, maybe in Scotland, I forget which, these figures became known as Sheila na Gaeg figures, or Sheilas. And the tradition often, as I understand it, at least in many cases, was that it would be over an archway, like right at the apex, and you would touch it. You'd reach your hand up and tag it as you walked underneath. And so they're often very worn from hundreds of years of people touching these things as they walk by with their hands. And it's a completely batshit weird thing, and it's really obscure because most of them were destroyed during the Victorian era because they were, you know, kind of weird and disgusting and so forth. And so a lot of them were destroyed. And there's a book published in the 70s, I think, or late 60s. It's kind of an art, like a coffee table book, called The Witch on the Wall. That's a document, you know, documenting this phenomenon and photographing as many examples as are still extant. And it was such a fascinating thing. And actually, PJ Harvey has a song called Sheila na Gaeg that's kind of referencing this. But it turned up in my research, and I realized, like, well, Sheila na Gaeg sounds like Shub-Niggurath. And, of course, it's all fertility-based, and it's vaginas and the whole thing, right? And so I ended up making linking. And once you think about Shub-Niggurath and fertility and you know, fecund, you know, vaginas and all this kind of thing, right, you go straight to King Arthur. Because King Arthur is tied to the land, and the health of the king is the health of the land. And in the same way that, you know, that Shub-Niggurath has this kind of fertility impulse behind it. And so once you make that connection, then you begin to think about that, and that's Golden Dawn. That's sort of where the framework for that campaign came from, was this idea that, you know, that therefore King Arthur must have been some kind of primitive, you know, Shub-Niggurath worshiper who was essentially just like making the land fertile. Making the crops grow, making the rains come, like keeping the people alive and healthy and fed. And that's why he was successful, right? Because he did this. And therefore, the Sheila na Gaeg are these representations of Shub-Niggurath from the Arthurian era. And that's the whole framework of that campaign. And that all just came out of research. Like, that's all it was. And once you begin to put the pieces together, then you see these little places where there are connections. And then the shit just writes itself. Like, it's just kind of straightforward at that point. And then all you have to do is figure out, like, what is the mystery? What is the story I'm going to tell that's going to expose this really awesome historical interest area?
Yeah. And with something like Delta Green, especially since it's modern day, you know, you're especially bringing in a lot of ideas from other people, you know, from other people's backgrounds. You're not looking as much at the ancient world in most cases.
Yeah.
But since it's a modern setting, you've got access to a lot of people that have really strange histories or you know, things that they've gone through that, seen through a certain lens, you know, can mm-hmm. become really creepy elements.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know that, if I remember right, Dennis, you know, did a lot of stuff on the fake, basically sort of remembering his teenage years in New York City, you know,
at
the end of the 80s when, you know, there was so much weird stuff going on. At least
it was that urban blight where people were still post. I think it was mostly there was a period of time in the cities with, you know, national bankruptcies and Ford refusing to, was it New York that President Ford refused to help them bail them out when the city was going bankrupt?
No, I don't remember that.
But it was, you know, there was a period of time when cities were just seen as, in the late 70s, early 80s, were seen as just these decaying holes where apparently civilizations go to die.
Right, and that's where you see movies like Death Wish, you know, and The Warriors back from that era.
Yeah, so. Escape from New York even, you know, was based on that same fear that rather than being the places where you go to make civilization, that cities were these anchors dragging out down the whole country when we should all be living in the suburbs, you know, 10 minutes from a mall, you know, because that's where real life was. And certainly, you know, Dennis delivers that with the Fate, with this kind of, you know, where New York becomes this inexplicable, you know, organism that's organized by guys you're never going to be able to communicate with or comprehend, you know, because it's all somebody else's agenda. You know, it wouldn't be like this if somebody didn't want it to be like this. At least that's what I always took away from his material on millennial New York.
Well, you know, that reminds me on the topic of awesome things in Delta Green that I didn't have a damn thing to do with. I thought Dennis's Project Rainbow was just fucking
brilliant. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is one of the most. That is absolutely.
Yeah, that was just breathtakingly good. And I wish he would actually turn. Well, he has played with that in the fiction, but like that specific investigation, I kind of wish was just its own thing entirely. It's such good work. I loved it entirely.
It really accomplished every goal we had with Delta Green. When you connected the Greys to the Mego as this puppet show to keep the monkeys from freaking out when they're doing a deal. And connecting the idea, because Lovecraft had already come up with aliens doing deals with people, and here it was, you know, 60 years later in the conspiracy vernacular of aliens doing deals with people who this time are in the government. You know, that was a great that to me was, you know, one of the things that really sold me on Delta Green when I first read it in The Oath. And I felt that the most successful thing after The Greys was Project Rainbow to me.
Yeah,
where the taking of a well-known conspiracy theory that it was out there, something that has generated material for decades, and then suddenly being able to go, and guess what? Here's the mythos story that totally undermines what you thought you were talking about.
Yeah,
you know, or not just undermines, but simultaneously, you know, backs it up even more. You know, the way that you took Whisper and Darkness, and you knit Whisper and Darkness into the modern, you know, UFO saucer people sort of conspiracy. So Project Rainbow was just perfect on that for the Philadelphia experiment.
Yep. Yeah, it was breathtaking.
And I've been stumbling around trying to find out what's the next thing we can come up with that, you know, where's our next. And it's tough. It's tough finding the next thing to get in.
The Amityville Horror.
Yeah, well, you know, exactly. You don't want it to be too hackneyed, but boy, those two right there are two of the ones that sell it the most to me, at least, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things I really liked about Project Rainbow was that role-playing games really don't get time travel very well, very often. They don't really set it up. I mean, there's, you know, on one hand you have there's games like Continuum, which are, you know, insane, and I don't know if anyone can actually play that. But Project Rainbow really sets up a really, like, understandable time travel sort of campaign or idea that you could actually run and keep track of, you know, because the elements are relatively isolated and it's really, you could understand where all the parts are and what would happen if the players did this or that. I don't know if that, just mentioning the time travel bit is spoiling it, but I really like that aspect of it.
So. The book's been out for 10 years. If they haven't read it yet, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, as far as spoiler, I mean, it's the Philadelphia experiment. So if you know anything about that, you know.
Yeah, but marrying it to the Tillinghast resonator.
Right.
Oh,
right.
That's juicy stuff.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. I know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Well, John, can you, from your perspective, you know, what is... I guess what is it like writing for the mythos, whether it's Delta Green or just taking a step back and looking at the Cthulhu mythos in general? You know, how does that differ? The approach to it differ from other things, or does it?
Well, I mean, you know, fundamentally, I mean, it's like with Lovecraft. I mean, you have some idea of a story you want to tell. And whether that's a single story, like literally a short story, or whether it's, you know, the story of this conspiracy of agents working together kind of thing, they're still stories. I think that the great strength and curse of the mythos as it's come to be over the years, over the, you know, almost 100 years at this point, is that you've got so many touch points where you can pull in connections and you can weave, you know, strands together. At the same time, you've got that risk that anyone who knows this stuff is like, oh, it's Cthulhu again, yawn. And it's, you know, there's so much that's been overused and become trite as well. I mean, I bear some responsibility for introducing the world to plush Cthulhu dolls myself, but I still look at the you know, endlessly multiplying numbers of Cthulhu themed kind of jokey games and products out there, and it just turns me off. It's not my thing at all.
We've all seen the Kavalik thing about Cthulhu, yes, being the bacon.
The new bacon, exactly. Yeah, no, John got it right. Yeah, and it's, you know, so it's a double-edged sword. But, I mean, honestly, like, to me, the key is that it's got to be your motivation. If your motivation is that, you know, I want to, you know, write a story that's got Shantax and, you know, Dimensional Shamblers in it, then, you know, you're already doomed. I mean, if that's your motivation, then, you know, please just don't. Just don't. Say, spare us and spare the, you know, electricity the world could use elsewhere. But if your motivation is to tell a good story, then and you see a way to do that within the mythos that's kind of fun and interesting and has some originality to it, then by all means do so. It's very useful. I mean, in the same way that world history is useful, or the history of the U.S. intelligence agencies, or the true story of the Golden Dawn and all the stuff with Yates and Company and Mathers and all that. I mean, there's lots of great useful resources out there you can draw on if you want to. So it's the mythos is very, very useful, but it does, like, it carries a penalty, and you have to, if you can't write your way around that penalty, then you're just another, you know, kind of hack pastichist. But hopefully you've got the originality and the drive to do something really unusual with it, and then it pays off big.
So John, what's up with Puppet Land?
So, well, that's been kind of a surprising turn for me lately. I've been working at Microsoft last 4.5 years, making video games for the Xbox. And in August of this year, I changed jobs and left games, left the Xbox group entirely. And the stuff I'm doing is great. I love it. It's actually been some of the most satisfying work I've done since Pagan. But it turns out that, you know, I've spent my life since age 19 making and shipping products. And since August, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not shipping anything resembling a product in any traditional sense. And what I found after the first couple months of kind of getting my feet under me and doing this stuff is that I began to realize that I actually had some energy and desire to make things on my own time, which has not really existed for years because I've been so consumed making things in my day job all day. But now I actually feel that I've got some energy to burn. And so I kind of looked around at things I was interested in picking up, things that have been kind of in the back of my mind for a long time, and decided that the thing I most wanted to tackle first was Puppet Land. Puppet Land was a experimental role-playing game that I designed and published on my website back in 1995. And it's a diceless, you know, collaborative storytelling kind of game that at the time I wrote as just kind of a lark, just kind of a little side project that I thought, you know, no one's ever going to publish this thing. Not even Pagan's going to publish this crazy thing. I'll just stick it on my website and I'll be done with it. But it got picked up. It got printed in a British Games magazine. Then it got published by Hogshead Publishing in 99. And ended up being what turned out to be a forerunner to the whole indie RPGs movement. You know, it was a very short, like 32-page, you know, kind of diceless experimental storytelling game, and has been out of print now for about a decade. And it's a completely batshit concept that I've been playing with for a long time, where it's this land of puppets. It's a magical land of puppets where puppets have sentient life. And the whole land and the puppets are made by this human known as the Maker. And the Maker has now been murdered by a particularly brutal puppet known as Punch from the Punch and Judy puppet shows. And Punch has murdered the Maker and cut off his face and is now wearing his face to make himself like a human, you know, kind of pretending to be a god, essentially. And Punch has now taken control of all puppet land. And he's this, you know, just this brutal, fascist, horrible despot. As someone recently made the joke, it is, in fact, a puppet regime. And so the players took the roles of puppets in Puppetland who are trying to overthrow Punch and save the day and the whole thing. And it's this kind of, you know, sort of creation folklore story sort of thing, all gone horribly, brutally, bloodily wrong. Which is hilarious because Puppetland was used by a graduate student at Rutgers University some years ago to teach creative writing to 8 to 10 year old children. And he would have them, you know, make up their puppets and they'd play through a session of Puppetland together. And the kids would then go off and kind of write and draw stories about their adventures.
So you don't have any liability for this, right, John? There's no way this is gonna, this is his fucking fault. That this is not your fault.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And to be clear, like, I'm sure he toned it down and so forth. But it was funny when he was doing the class for a couple semesters. I got an email from the mother of one of the boys in the class, and she wanted to send me a story he'd written and a drawing he'd made of his character in Puppetland and so forth. And she just had gotten in touch with me because she was excited about this thing that her son had done. And I sent encouraging words and so forth. So it's a strange little thing. So Puppetland, I am currently working on a new edition of, and so I've been working on the manuscript. I'm going to add a bit to it. Puppetland was only ever a, you know, a little 32 page kind of book. It's very short. And it's not particularly in need of a a bold new innovation in diceless resolution systems or anything. But there are some places that could really help new GMs to run Puppetland and have a good time with it. And so I'm doing some work on the manuscript now to make a new edition of the game. And sometime soonish, maybe before the end of the year, maybe early next year, I'm going to launch a Kickstarter for Puppetland to bring it back as an ebook and a limited edition hardcover. And I'm going to get that back out there so that it's available again. And I'm excited to do that stuff. I mean, I've got some energy to burn now at this point. And it's also one of the things that working in video games, as I have been for a long time now, is that, you know, when you're kind of in the sort of lead designer sort of role, you don't really get a lot of hands-on work. You know, I write documents, I go to do a lot of discussions with team members and so forth, but I'm not sort of making stuff. I'm not actually implementing content or rules or whatever. It's all been very kind of high-level abstracted work, which has been fun, interesting, but I'm very used to, from all the years of Pagan, doing things myself. And so I wanted to do that with this project as well. And so I'm gonna go ahead and do the layout in the book and kind of redesign it and do the whole thing myself, because it's going to give me great pleasure to do so. And once I get Puppetland done and get it back out there through Kickstarter, then my next project is probably going to be a new edition of my King and Yellow stories, the fiction that I wrote over the years with the stories Broad Albin, Ambrose, and Sesostris.
Mr. Tynes, may I ask a question about the King and Yellow cult stories?
Why, no, you may not.
Okay, then we're moving along. Let's get back on track.
No, please do. Please do.
Well, I when I heard a couple years back somebody was going, now, what was the deal where you got some of those stories republished recently in the last couple of years?
Like 4 years ago or so, there was I think it was Elder Signs Press did a King and Yellow anthology called Wisp. No, sorry, I'm looking at it right here. It's Rehearsals for Oblivion is the name of it. And they were going to reprint all three stories in that anthology, and which to me was like, oh, great, that'll be done with. I don't have to worry about it anymore. But they ended up only having room for one. And yeah. they were hoping to publish the second and third stories in the second volume of that series, but there never was one. And okay. So I think all they published was Broad Alban.
Okay. The reason I asked is I remember that it wasn't the complete. Something happened, and they didn't do the thing. And my horrible memory was that they only missed one. They put two in and then just pulled left one out just to completely cock block you on getting those things, just to torment you. But I'm glad to hear it was only one story because, yeah, I'd love to see that collection out. There's lots of people who are waiting for that.
Yeah, I just grabbed the book off the shelf now to see because I can't remember myself. And indeed, let's see. It had Broad Alban and, it had Ambrose as well. Yeah, it had two of the three. Yeah, so it had Broad Alban and Ambrose. And Sesostris is as long as both of those put together. Sesostris is really a novella. And it's kind of where I pulled together all the storylines that I was working on with the King of Hell stuff at that point. So that's the one that's been – because those three stories were published only as 100-copy limited edition chapbooks way, way back at Pagan. And so almost no one has ever gotten to read the damn things. So I'll do that next, and that'll be, hopefully, if all goes well, that'll be my second Kickstarter project, maybe in the spring or something. And kind of once I get to that point, and this is sort of my nefarious long-term plan, having done those two projects, I'll then be ready to do something original at that point. And so I'm kind of want to get to that point where people actually know that I'm doing stuff again and that there's a way to get these things and so forth. And I'll have some experience under my belt as well. So I'm looking towards next year to do several projects and have some fun with it, which will be a good time. But what those will be and when they'll come out is very much TBD at this point.
Right.
All right.
Great
well,
to
excellent.
Hear.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to new, fiction. Or I haven't read your Yellow Sign story, so I'm looking forward to that. And Puppetland sounds great. It sounds kind of thematically similar to Little Fears and Monsters and Other Childish Things, both of which are games I admire.
Except that Punch the Maker Killer is just oh fucking shit. that guy Punch the Maker Killer is just a slice of nightmare. He really is, John.
Yeah,
I was always repelled and horrified by. I mean, you're describing Punch like a fascist dictator, but I'm sorry. It was like having Uday Hussein. in charge, where you can never tell from one moment to another whether he's going to be putting his cigar out on you or raping a puppet in front of you. It was just horrible.
Yeah,
absolutely horrible.
Well, and one of the great weird stories about Puppetland is that it was purchased by Hollywood. That many years ago, an independent film studio bought the movie rights to Puppetland and still own them to this day. And they wanted to do it as like a Pixar style, big budget CGI movie for the whole family.
Hmm. What?
Yeah, I know. It's completely weird.
With Punch with his raggedy meat slab on it. That it's, if I remember... There's nails in it that go through the meat into the puppet head with his googly puppet eyes looking out the dead eye holes, which are like uneven and kind of floppy with their floppy.
Well, it's like the Devil's Rock you were talking about earlier. At first it started Lovecrafty, and then they kind of, why don't we make it just a generic devil? It's probably going to get a little lost in translation.
I think there would have been certain economies taken with the text for sure. And honestly, at the time, I was like all in favor, like, sure, what the hell? But it really reminded me a lot of like a compressed version of what's happened with Little Red Riding Hood, where the early versions of the story are a lot more kind of bloody and disturbing. And by the time you get to, like the Bugs Bunny version or whatever, like it's completely been bolderized. And it's been all that stuff has been stripped away. And what's left is a fairly simple and still effective story. And to me, it was kind of like, that's going to happen, except it's going to be across like 4 years instead of, 400. And we're going to go from this like mythic, resonant, disgusting, weird, primal version to Happy Meals in a handful of years.
Perhaps a Punch the Maker Killer toy can come with my food.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that's probably the right verb. And the other weird thing about this is that the guy who bought the rights that still owns the rights to Puppetland for Hollywood is Courtney Solomon, who is the director of the Dungeons and Dragons movie.
That's right.
you're in good hands, Mr. Chimes.
Yeah,
I see a Sci-Fi Channel film in your future.
Yeah, well, and at the time that we did the deal for Puppetland, the D&D movie didn't exist yet. He was still working on it. He had screenplays. He was trying to get the deal together, et cetera. That was still, you know, because and Courtney, I mean, he worked on that D&D movie for like a decade. Because he went off and got the rights from TSR, and it was just this long, epic journey to make his dream project. And along the way, he was signing up other projects and trying to get things off the ground and so forth. And so he bought the rights to Puppetland. And at the time, I read a draft of the D&D movie that he had from his writers for that project. And actually, I kind of liked it. It was very different from where the movie ended up in terms of some of the storyline. It had a whole section where they go through like the underground, you know, halls of the dead and the drow and stuff, I think. And it was kind of cool, but it was still the same thing he tried to make, which was the sort of Spielbergian kind of pop version of D&D, like an 80s Spielberg movie, which I think is what he was going for. It ended up being, you know, a fairly, what it is. Yeah. You know, he was definitely a passion project for him. Didn't quite work out that great, but he's still making movies. He's still, you know, producing things here and there. I haven't talked to him in years. I have no idea if Puppetland will ever come out. I can't imagine it will, but that was a funny and strange thing to have happen along the way.
Hmm. Clearly, wow. Your new edition of Puppetland is going to be what jumpstart Puppetland film, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
That's how I see this going.
Yeah.
Get DreamWorks on the phone. So.
That's right. That's my worst nightmare is DreamWorks does it.
you don't want Chris Rock being the voice of Punch?
Oh, mother of God in heaven. No, anyway. Yeah. Yep. So that's the Puppetland story.
Yeah.
And
I just remember John turning to me when people were talking about buying the rights to Delta Green at one point. John turned to me and said, "Dude, we're going to be action figures." And you seemed pleased at the time, but clearly all that naive enthusiasm has been bludgeoned out of you over the last few hundred projects.
You know, I wouldn't say that. I just say that I always had a highly developed appreciation for the absurd.
Fair enough. All right. I think that kind of summarizes as much as we need to. I think that kind of covers all the main topics for this episode. On that note of action figures, Delta Green. Who would you want to see as a Delta Green action figure? Nancy? Alphonse?
Clearly, you're going to have the Nancy one with action brain eating.
Right. Yeah, you got to have the thing where you can pull her head off and replace it with a ghoul head and so forth.
Oh, and you need the special limited edition Andrea figure. It's like you just have a question mark on the thing, and they have to go to a Comic Con or something to get it. And it costs like $500. And so, yeah. You know, only the most hardcore otaku can get it.
Yeah, that's the empty box action figure.
Exactly. All right. Well, this is Ross Payton with Unspeakable, along with Shane Ivey, John Scott Tynes, and Scott Lancey. And we'll see you guys next time.
Thanks, guys. See ya.
Yeah. long time, and we have many things to do, and you are not sure what you are doing.